Are you searching for the best in online black radio? Then go to blacktalkradionetwork.com, helping you filter through the noise. Real talk, black talk.
The internet is full of half-truths and all-out lies. We've all seen them, and many people on social media complaining about it. Here's your chance to show and prove. WorldAfropedia.com is a black-owned and operated encyclopedia. There are several thousand articles, but we need help. We can't uncover all the truth ourselves. So please, join us and become a writer, editor, or blogger for WorldAfropedia.com today. Every little bit counts. We owe it to the future generations to put the truth out there. Visit WorldAfropedia.com, the African-centered encyclopedia, a global database of African knowledge for the purpose of bringing about global African wisdom and understanding. WorldAfropedia.com.
Seattle's a great place to visit because it has, I guess you could say, a little bit of everything, but I like to think of it as a lot of everything.
Our region was built with immigrant labor. It's part of the story of growth and development here. There are many ways to tell that history. How we tell it signals who belongs and who is a foreigner. That's also true in Black Diamond, an old mining town about to become home to a large housing development. It's known for its Welsh and Irish heritage, but that's not the whole story. Today, we bring you the story of Black Diamond's hidden Asian American history.
And one cherry fritter and one apple fritter.
Ask anyone if they've been to Black Diamond, and they're likely to mention the bakery. It's a place that everyone stops at when they go skiing at Crystal Mountain. The bakery first opened in 1902, and it's still going strong.
Thank you so much, and I have a slice of bread for you.
Okay. And this is the bread. This is 115 years old recipe we are using it, the Crystal Mountain bread.
I got one of everything that I didn't get last time. Right.
Moon Bang bought the iconic bakery about 10 years ago. She became the guardian of its 115-year history. To some people, that seemed incongruous.
They said, you need to go home. It was a shock.
And where was home anyway? Once Bang lived in South Korea, where she worked for the government. But women weren't expected to have careers. She came here instead. Eventually, she became a U.S. citizen, so this was her home. She spent almost two decades running a dry cleaner's in Auburn so she could send her two daughters to a private Christian school. When the Black Diamond Bakery came on the market, it just felt right.
It's quiet country and nice view. Yes.
She and her husband threw themselves into it. They added dinner and evening jazz performances. Even 10 years later, they still work until midnight most nights, ordering food and prepping stuff. If a baker calls in sick or something breaks, they stay all night.
Yeah, spend the night. Sometimes 2 days we didn't sleep. Nothing.
So when people told her she didn't belong in Black Diamond, it stung. On the outside, she held her composure and smiled.
I was even inside, I have to crying and mad. I have to holding my breath.
People have been telling Asian Americans they didn't belong in this part of King County for a long time. The seeds of that resentment go back to at least the 1870s. That's when Chinese workers helped to build the railroad spurs serving the county's coal mines. Here's local archaeologist Ben Bronson.
One of the big advantages of Chinese laborers compared to their white competitors is they didn't get drunk on weekends.
Alcohol was a big problem in mining towns, especially among the white workers.
If you were an American contractor who are hiring white laborers, you had to worry about the fact you wouldn't get anything done on Monday because everybody would still be asleep.
Bronson says that and other things led unions to resent the Chinese. In 1882, the U.S. banned Chinese laborers from coming into the country. Bronson's partner is archaeologist Shui Mei Ho. She tells the story of what happened to Chinese railroad workers after they were hired as miners in Black Diamond.
A group of Chinese, they live together, you know, they all live in one big house. And according to the newspaper report,
unidentified assailants set fire to the house. The archaeologists I talked to think it's pretty clear it was probably union workers. These kinds of things happened all over the West as anti-Chinese sentiment grew. Black Diamond avoided the worst of the bloodshed.
The building was burned down, but the Chinese managed to escape in time, so no one was hurt.
But even with the Chinese workers chased out of Black Diamond, there were still traces of their presence. Rose Murdoch grew up in Black Diamond. As we speak on the phone, she and I both open Google Maps and fly over the house in Black Diamond where she grew up.
You know where the cul-de-sac is?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, there's a drop-off there that goes down into a gully. And there was a big train trestle track, you know, all made out of wood, crisscrossed, how they used to do it.
Mm-hmm.
He just said that the Chinese worked on the railroads and that two of them were buried in that field. And he didn't know what happened to them, but he just said that, you know, he was told that they were buried there.
But those Chinese workers are probably gone now. Their bodies would have been dug up and returned to China. That was written into their labor contracts and was taken very seriously. Rahul Gupta of the Wing Luke Museum says that common practice partly explains how we can sometimes undervalue the role Asian Americans played in growing and developing our region.
In Western culture, you put a headstone, right? You put a headstone and you have people remember you. Well, that's how you make a mark if you passed away in an area, if you settled. Well, it's not the way it worked for at least the Chinese population. They were exhuming their bodies so they could have proper burials in China.
And it wasn't just the Chinese. Sikhs also helped build the region's railroads. Filipinos worked the land. Japanese Americans also had a major presence in the Green River Valley between Black Diamond and Auburn. They owned berry farms. Jean Beers was their neighbor.
Yeah, it's kind of sad. It's kind of sad to see them all gone.
It's easy to forget the history and how Asian Americans helped grow and develop the region because the record is so ephemeral as memory and some pieces of paper. How we remember that history influences how we see someone like Moon Bang, who bought the Black Diamond Bakery, and whether she belongs.
Well, I'm American citizen too. I'm here for, you know, working and pay tax. You know, I'm a little shorter and then little have an accent. You know, why we have to have that kind of, you know, discrimination.
But people are coming around. Remember the customers who didn't like her? At least one of them changed their mind.
One people came and apologized to me. Yes.
What did they say?
They said, I'm sorry, but I didn't know you. And then you are really working hard and then really change the bakery. And, you know, from now I can come, they said.
They could come and be a customer again.
Oatmeal fudge bar, a chocolate eclair, and a macaroon brownie, and one of everything.
For KUOW's Region of Boom team, I'm Joshua McNichols in Black Diamond.
It all looks wonderful.
Billie Holiday, I sing your blues. Bet your life against me and I swear to God you'll lose it. Motherfuck the cops, we still singing for St. Louis. Motherfuck the cops, we still singing for St. Louis. Motherfuck the cops, we still singing for St. Louis.
The city of Maplewood is under fire after a local nonprofit calls the city's housing laws discriminatory and put domestic violence victims at risk. Five on Your Side's PJ Randhawa is live in our studio now to explain the allegations in a federal lawsuit filed this week. PJ?
Kay, the group behind this is a nonprofit fair housing group, the Metropolitan St. Louis Equal Housing and Opportunity Council, or EHOC. Their lawsuit focuses on the part of a Maplewood City ordinance that deals with nuisances. Now, Maplewood households can be considered a nuisance for a long list of reasons, but according to this lawsuit, calling the police two or more times within 180 days, that's about 6 months, could put you on that list. That includes people calling for domestic disturbances. Now, EHOC says residents deemed a nuisance can lose their Maplewood occupancy permit and are no longer allowed to live in that city. EHOC said it reviewed nuisance cases in Maplewood in recent years and found the majority of nuisance enforcement was taken against African American residents, domestic violence survivors, and people with disabilities.
Although Maplewood claims this promotes public safety, this chronic nuisance ordinance does no such thing, we believe. Instead, it makes the community less safe by discouraging crime victims and other residents from contacting the police.
Well, the city of Maplewood said they just received notice of that lawsuit today. The city manager said he couldn't comment until he had a chance to fully read it. But he did say the city hadn't had a conversation with EHOC to this point, and the lawsuit came as a bit of a surprise. Mike?
PJ, thanks.
Is that a real gun?
Yes, it's a real gun.
Do you kill people?
No, if some guy's hurting someone, I try to shoot him in the leg or something, just to stop him.
Mama says police misshoot black people.
Is it true? Is it true? Is that true?
Is that true?
Fox 8 I-Team has learned that the first internal discipline handed out in connection with the Tamir Rice shooting. A dispatcher has been suspended 8 days, and a patrol officer who's working off-duty has been suspended 2 days. A hearing still has not been held for Officer Timothy Lohman, who fired the shot that killed the 12-year-old, and no decision was made for his partner, Frank Garmbach. In a statement, Samaria Rice called the punishments unacceptable and pathetic.
King Kong. That was about Jack Johnson and the white ladies.
Yes.
Did it take place in New York City?
Yes, sir.
Empire State Building?
Yes, sir.
Did it take place there? Well, now think about this for a minute. You born a gorilla. What a gorilla going to do in New York? It ain't no trees, and Lord, no, ain't no bananas. You hear me? So then after you get through with that, why would it take place in New York? Madison Square Garden is the boxing capital of the world.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? The symbolism. You know, so when you sit around and think about what images can do, it's incredible.
King Kong has been around almost as long as Hollywood itself. The first Kong movie was in 1933, and from its inception, it's always been loaded with some ugly racial subtext. Ridiculous caricatures of natives, white men protecting a white woman from the savages, and a giant, dangerous black creature from the jungle.
Every one of the King Kong movies has the same basic setup. There's a ship of explorers in search of a mysterious, uncharted place called Skull Island.
An island hidden by a perpetual fog bank. Never seen by human eye, nor walked by human foot, huh?
That clip was from the 1976 version of Kong. As in the other four versions, Skull Island is usually located somewhere vaguely near Indonesia, even though it seems to be inhabited by savages who look suspiciously like black people, decked out in full movie cannibal chic, loincloths and spears and drums, and they become entranced, invariably, by the absolutely irresistible woman traveling with the explorers.
He says, look at the golden woman.
Yeah, blondes are scarce around here.
That blonde, Faye Ray in the 1933 original, Jessica Lange in the 1976 remake, and later Naomi Watts in Peter Jackson's 2005 retelling, is kidnapped by the natives, who sacrifice her to their titanic gorilla god. Kong, the giant rampaging ape who somehow happens to have a deep cross-species preference for flaxen-haired white ladies. And this is where the racial antenna goes up for people like Robin Means Coleman. She's a professor at the University of Michigan who has studied King Kong and racial representation over the years.
King Kong was clearly also a metaphor for race, for black masculinity. That's the low-hanging fruit of black metaphors.
Coleman says you can draw a direct line from The Birth of a Nation, that defining 1915 film about the black male threat to white women, and coincidentally, the movie that helped resurrect the Ku Klux Klan, and King Kong in 1933. King Kong premiered at a time when black men were regularly depicted as ape-like. It was during the beginning of the Great Migration, when thousands and thousands of black people were leaving the South to move to the nation's biggest cities.
This is, again, a big black man, right? A big black ape who is absolutely obsessed with whiteness and particularly white women. That has to be cut down.
So, can you make a movie about King Kong without perpetuating these creepy racial undertones? Let's look at the newest movie, Kong Skull Island. The woman is now a strawberry blonde, played by Brie Larson, who is mostly, besides the point this time, the natives in this movie don't talk in any Oonga Boonga speak, because they actually don't speak at all. And the big bad black guy is Sam Jackson, an American military commander who wants revenge against Kong. Alyssa Rosenberg is a culture critic at The Washington Post.
A literal African-American man versus a metaphorical stand-in for Black American men. It's meant to steer clear of the idea that white men are protecting a white woman from the stand-in for Black men.
Rosenberg said that Kong is kind of an anti-colonial figure in this latest film. He's protecting his island and its inhabitants from violent invaders. But still, it's King Kong.
Right, and I think the movie is trying really hard to have the awesome big monster fights without stepping into any of those racial implications, but I think they're just unavoidable.
So yeah, King Kong, a 100-foot-tall gorilla who can go toe-to-toe with military choppers, Godzilla, Charles Grodin, and Sam Jackson, but the ideas that spawned him have proven much harder to smack down. Gene Demby, NPR News.
King Kong ain't got shit on me!
His name is Delbert Africa, a well-known member of the MOVE organization of Philadelphia. But if you're in your 20s or 30s or even your 40s, you may be forgiven if you don't know the name. That's because he's perhaps best known as the man who was brutally punched, kicked, rifle-butted, and stomped by police when he got arrested. And this happened long before the infamous Rodney King police beating in Los Angeles. That's because Delbert was assaulted on video in August 1978, one of the earliest MOVE confrontations. Africa, like other MOVE members, have taught younger prisoners in ways to appreciate and become closer to their families. That sense of service, which is deep in MOVE, doesn't douse his fire. Listen for yourself.
My name's Delbert Africa from the MOVE organization. I just want to say the MOVE organization is a family of strong, serious, deeply committed revolutionaries founded by a wise, perceptive, strategically minded Black man named John Africa. John Africa took each and every MOVE member from the weak-bodied, sick, inactive, apathetic persons that we were and molded us into strong revolutionaries that are committed to doing away, eliminating this system, not reforming it, not changing the government, but eliminating this whole oppressive system.
Delbert Africa is a revolutionary who's just as steadfast in his belief as he was back in the 70s. That's because he's seen and experienced things that would astonish people. Remember that kicking and stomping I mentioned earlier? You ever wonder what happened to those cops caught on video? Well, in a word, nothing. But that's a story for another day. Delbert Africa issues a call to all social, radical, and revolutionary movements to keep on fighting.
What I'm here today, thanks to Noel Hanrahan and Prison Radio, is a call for everybody else out there, I don't care who you are, to become and stay revolutionary. Because revolution is not a philosophy, it ain't a theory, it's an activity. If you still worshiping money, if you still doing drugs, if you abusing your mate, then you ain't revolting against this system. You helping this system keep this same thing going. And what I'm saying is, I want the Echo Warriors to keep on fighting. I want Black Lives Matter to keep on revolting. I want the Animal Liberationists to keep on fighting. Those who are defending the native lands out there in South Dakota against that oppressive pipeline, keep on fighting. Don't let this system put you down. I want everybody in the LGBTQ community, keep on fighting. Don't give in. This is what John Africa has taught MOVE, not to ever give in to this oppressive system. It don't matter about jail. It don't matter about prison. We know that we can keep on and we won't be stopped.
Delbert Africa specifically sent his salute to the Black Lives Matter movement, adding that he loved those young folks. He ain't alone in that. From Imprisoned Nation, this is Mumia Abu-Jamal.
Flores Forbes joined the Black Panther Party when he was just 16 years old. He became the youngest member of the party's central committee and eventually got recruited into its military arm. In the late 70s, he was involved in an attempted murder plot and served 5 years in prison. While he was there, he encountered Ralph Ellison's novel, Invisible Man. That novel's premise lingered with him after he was released and eventually became the focal point of his new book. It's a look at how Black men remain invisible even after they've left prison. Flores Forbes is an urban planner and university administrator at Columbia University in New York City. He authored a book, Invisible Men, a contemporary slave narrative in the era of mass incarceration, And he joins me now, Flores Forbes. Welcome to the State of Things. Good to talk with you.
Hey, good to be here.
Take us back to those early years. You grew up in San Diego, California. You had challenging encounters with the police from a very young age. Tell us about that.
When I was 12 years old, I was kidnapped by the police. They saw me riding my bike down the street. They told me to stop, put me in the car, drove me several miles away to a kind of informal lineup for a white couple. They were looking for someone who had snatched a woman's purse. And then they brought me back when the couple said that it wasn't me. And, insulted my mother. And, you know, it was kind of one of the first, you know, incidents. And I was very naive at the time. I was only 12. But then a few years later, while I was playing football or working out, trying to make the weight for my Pop Warner football team, I was accosted by about 20 policemen at a high school field where I was working out, and I was beat up. And if it wasn't for the only black policeman in San Diego at the time who was there, I went to school with his son, I don't even know if I'd be here today.
Well, you were, and am I right, you were running around a track at the time?
Yeah. I mean, I know, you know, even when I thought about it years later when I was writing about it in my first book, it kind of struck me as a coincidence, you know, that they saw me running. There were other people running from some other incident that was in the area. And I guess they just assumed that I was part of that group.
So you joined the Black Panther Party when you were just 16 years old. Tell us about that decision and what happened when you did that, how that was for you.
Well, I mean, I joined because I felt like I and many other young black men in San Diego were being terrorized by the police. My brother, who was a freshman at UCLA, he also joined. And, at the time, we believed that this was a big issue for us. It wasn't, during the Civil Rights Movement, obviously they were fighting more against Jim Crow, and we were dealing with other issues of, basically police repression.
You were dealing with those, but it's interesting, and I want to sort of get a sense of what the evolution was like for you. Because you said at the age of 12, you were naive. You thought, well, yeah, that's the kind of thing that happens, and you just sort of brushed it off. 14, it happens again. When's the moment when you say, wait a minute, this is systemic repression, and I need to do something about it?
I started reading. My brother was bringing home books from UCLA, and I was reading them. And also, the Black Panther Party had been founded, and their newspapers were circulating throughout California. And my brother was getting access to them through the Black Student Union at UCLA. And so I started reading this, and I started seeing the reports in the news about the armed patrols that the Black Panthers had instituted to monitor police activity. And then I believe it was around in May of 1967, I saw the big news report of the Panthers going to the Sacramento Capitol protesting. They were lobbying, basically, protesting the change in the gun law, which would restrict them from carrying loaded weapons in an unincorporated area. And, I kind of felt that this, these were mostly black men, many of them young black men. And I felt that if I was going to survive, I needed to join this organization to fight back.
Yeah, it's interesting. It's one of the few times in American history when gun control could have any kind of traction, mostly because it was aimed at communities of color. You were recruited into the military arm of the party, though, and again at an early age. I'm trying to get your vision at this moment. You're in the military arm. There's talking about Black Panthers armed in their neighborhoods to protect against police repression. This is inherent in the Second Amendment. You're going to be part of the military arm of the party. What did that mean to you, and what were your expectations? What did you think you were going to be doing?
Well, I mean, I basically thought I knew I was going to be protecting the leaders of the organization. We had gotten involved in electoral politics, and Bobby Seale was running for mayor, and other Panthers were running for city council seats. And we had other facilities where we needed to protect ourselves because there were other, you know, hostile elements in the community. I mean, you know, we didn't control the entire community. And so I thought this is what, you know, I was going to be involved in. I became very close with the party's founder, Huey P. Newton. And he was very eloquent in describing some of the things that we would need to do in order to basically kind of control our communities. You know, we had a 5-year plan where we said we were going to take over the political apparatus of the city of Oakland, and which controlled the actual port of Oakland, which is where all the resources were. And in this way, we were going to be able to finance any efforts that we had going forward. But probably one of the biggest impediments to this was a very thriving underground or underworld community of the San Francisco Oakland Bay Area. And Newton came up with an idea that, you know, we can't end all of the crime, or we can't end the drug distribution that's going on in the community. So he says, well, then we should regulate it. And we became, the people in the military, we became part of the group that started basically shaking down drug dealers, trying to put some sort of, for lack of a better word, trying to create a little more civil environment within a community where you did have a lot of you could say, as he called them, illegitimate capitalists.
Well, the civil environment did involve a lot of violence. You ended up in prison eventually. Tell us about that.
Right. You know, I was involved in an operation to kill a witness that was going to be testifying against Huey Newton. The operation got botched. I got wounded. Another Panther was killed. And I fled. And got medical treatment through our network, and so I was a fugitive for 3 years. And during that time, I discovered that my father had died, and I didn't know that he had been dead for like 2 years. So then I realized, and the organization was over. You know, the Black Panther Party pretty much had ended, and I had to make a decision on what I was going to do. So then I eventually turned myself in. I had a great lawyer, one of the best trial lawyers in the country, who took my case pro bono, and I fought the case, and I was convicted of felony murder with an arming and use clause because I had used a gun, and I was sentenced to 8 years to the California Department of Corrections, and I basically served 4 years, 8 months, and 9 days.
And in that nearly 5 years, you spent a lot of time reading, including Ralph Ellison's book, Invisible Man, and began to think about the concept of invisibility. Tell us about your meditations on that.
Well, I mean, you know, I was, you know, desperate to develop a plan on how I was going to reenter society. And I was taking college courses, which would eventually lead to a bachelor's degree. There was a course called The Masterpieces of American Literature. And Invisible Man was one of the books that was in that course. And I was just fascinated at the imagery and the metaphor of how Ralph Ellison told this story. And I never realized these many years later that I was going to see a parallel between the Invisible Man, basically Ellison's metaphor deals with the fact that white America refused to see black people. And I had developed this concept after 10 or 15 years as a free person after prison that I was also hiding. I was basically hiding in plain sight because I realized that, You know, going to prison was one thing, but the most difficult task that I ever had to perform was when you got out of prison, getting a job and reentering society. Look at the recidivism rate.
Well, that is the focus of your latest book, Invisible Man, a contemporary slave narrative in the era of mass incarceration. What are the challenges that you faced in reentry?
I mean, there are no opportunities, you know. The imbalance of the criminal justice system, or what I might call the prison industrial complex, of the investment that's made to keep you in prison, you know, and the fact that you're working for slave wages in California, and I think in many southern states, the inmates are paid nothing. And this is because of the 13th Amendment. 13th Amendment, the exception clause says that, you know, you're a slave when you go to prison. And so they don't have to pay you. And I, I realized that I had to develop my own concept of, you know, education, how I was going to reenter, because that journey is fraught with, you know, pitfalls. And so 70% of the people who go to prison, they don't make it back. I mean, they keep going back. Yeah. 30% that are out here, some sort of way, they all work it out. You know, I work around a lot of formerly incarcerated people now, and I hear all these different stories. Many of them are successful, but that's just a handful. And I realized that, my journey was one that I could use as an example. Like Toni Morrison says, you know, you should write books that you want to read. So I wrote this book because I thought it was a good story to help other formerly incarcerated people, and in particular black men, to see that there is a way that you can make it through this morass.
What are some of those lessons, and, you know, what would you tell others who are in your situation?
I mean, there's some basic things. There's a lot of research that's been done by academia. One academic in particular, Bruce Western at Harvard University, he looks at, you know, there are these, you know, these kind of major issues that you need to deal with, like education and skills. But probably the most important one is the development of a social network, social political network, so that you can help, you know, to help you navigate through the system. And probably the third one is you have to eventually remove the stigma of being incarcerated. And that is it's very difficult to do, especially with the box, which asks you to reveal whether you've been convicted of a felony. And then there's also the internal stigma that you have to combat, which is the post-traumatic stress syndrome that you more than likely suffer from the close quarters, living in prison, and the fact that, you know, your life is really in danger in many instances because of the prison culture that values space. And if you enter someone else's space, you can find yourself on the wrong end of a prison shank. Or if you're in the wrong place at the wrong time and something does go down and the guard towers and they shoot and you may get hit by a bullet, you know. So it's really, really complex in terms of being in there. And I thought that was really was an ordeal. But it was no way an ordeal until when I was released.
Well, and it seems to me that among the 30 to 35% who do make it, again, a recidivism rate of anywhere from 65 to 70%. So on the one hand, the penal system, punishing people by putting them in jail is a failure because people repeat and supposed to scare you into not doing it again. It's totally failed. It breaks the social networks that you say are required to reenter. So in breaking the very thing that could help you be a productive member of society, you're almost guaranteeing that that individual won't. In the meantime, traumatizing them. All of that. But I also think, and I'd like you to talk about this, for the 30 and 35% who are still out there, they're ultimately vulnerable. And so it means their opportunities are very much limited, which means employers know that. And they can be manipulated, and they're so in a lot of ways, their vulnerability leaves them in the same stressful condition that similar to a stressful condition that they were in when their behavior was controlled in prison.
Right, right. I mean, I didn't really seek out mental health professionals for assistance until I was out for 15 years. But I think that the main issue with regards to reentry is the imbalance in the investment in the criminal justice system. There are billions of dollars spent on confinement. And for each individual that's in prison, it varies from costs, you know, $50,000, $60,000. And if you're younger, I believe it costs more. When you leave prison, you get nothing. In California, you get $200, a bus ticket if you need it. And that's it. So with that type of reentry operation, and there's minimum stuff. I mean, there are programs that help you find housing, some housing. There are some that say they help you find jobs and or they, you know, line you up with someone who is friendly to people who are formerly incarcerated. But I think the biggest problem is that the imbalance and the lack of education for public policymakers and for the society to realize that you can't start anyone after prison with nothing. And that's almost impossible. So you're going to have a 70% recidivism rate.
You're an urban planner now, an administrator in an Ivy League university, Columbia. By those measures, you have made it. Do you feel that you've made it? And how does your past life live with the life you're living today?
Yeah, I mean, I felt I made it 15 years ago when I was a city planner here in New York City. And I feel great about, you know, my accomplishments. And now I realize that because I'm probably sitting in a place where there aren't very many people like myself, that I said, well, let me reach back and see what contribution that I can really make. So in many ways, I'm people already knew that I was had been to prison in all the positions I've had. You know, I think I only applied for a job once when I first got out of graduate school. After that, I had developed a network that was so effective that I was primarily recruited. I was recruited by the city of New York. I was recruited by Columbia University. You know, so I think that I'm trying to reach back to make a contribution by telling this story and telling the story in the way that people can understand, because I often repeat what I did. And I think that's one of the things that's really important, is for people to be able to say, this is what I did. I think that's the beginning of kind of removing the stigma internally. You know, the external piece is you know, that's a whole nother issue. I think that there needs to be education on both sides with regards to hiring managers, with regards to public policy makers, so that they understand that, you know, when they talk about saving money, that's a very ridiculous notion. When you're saying, well, we're going to save money and we're going to send somebody out there and we're going to give them $200 mm-hmm. like they do in California, or $40 like they do in New York City
yeah.
or New York State, and expect you to be successful. No one would be successful with that kind of lack of resource.
Flores Forbes, what a pleasure. Thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Flores Forbes is a university administrator, urban planner, and author of the book Invisible Men, A Contemporary Slave Narrative in the Era of Mass Incarceration.
I don't want us to lose sight that things are getting better. Each successive generation seems to be making progress in changing attitudes when it comes to race. Doesn't mean we're in a post-racial society. It doesn't mean that racism is eliminated. But, you know, when I talk to Malia and Sasha, and I listen to their friends and I see them interact, they're better than we are. They're better than we were on these issues. And that's true in every community that I've visited all across the country.
All right. Thank you, JP. New at 10 o'clock. The University of Alabama is investigating a student accused of sending racist rants to a woman on a popular dating site.
Ugochi Adloka joins us live with what happened here, Ugochi. Well, Jonathan, a woman who attends college in Virginia is the one who posted that viral message between her and the UA student in question on Facebook. Now, this all started when that student, a former Sigma Pi fraternity member, contacted her on Tinder asking if the black guy in her picture was her boyfriend.
The message goes on to say, "Ain't no one like an N-word loving white girl," wrote UA student Kyle Harcourt to Emmy Ann, who screenshotted it.
Some people who now feel that they have a platform and it's okay to say those things.
But the rant gets worse when Harcourt goes on to say, "I come from Alabama, where the only place we like our N-word is hanging from trees," which the students we ran into on campus found disturbing.
What does that to you?
We tried Harcourt's former frat house to see what members had to say. But no one was there. Sigma Pi did tweet how they condemned that type of behavior and that Kyle's membership was terminated.
What was it that made him feel that he could do this? And how can we, you know, stand together as young people and say that this is not who we are, this is not who Alabama is, this is not who our generation is?
In the message, Emmy told Kyle that his use of the N-word is racially violent and that there are no black men in any of her pictures. He also went on to use homophobic slurs, asking if gay people should have rights. This grad student says she believes there is something triggering his hate.
How do we take someone like Kyle, and how was he exposed at an earlier age to diversity? Plenty of studies show that the more exposure people have to diverse viewpoints, the more tolerant and the more understanding they become.
And the University of Alabama says that they do not condone any violent or racist language of any sort in any situation, and that they are addressing this incident appropriately. Reporting live in Tuscaloosa, Gauthier Loca, WBRC, Fox 6 News on your side.
We do not know whether the killer of Reverend Pinckney and 8 others knew all of this history. But he surely sensed the meaning of his violent act. It was an act that drew on a long history of bombs and arson and shots fired at churches. Not random, but as a means of control, a way to terrorize and oppress. An act that he imagined would incite fear and recrimination, violence and suspicion. An act that he presumed would deepen divisions that trace back to our nation's original sin. Oh, but God works in mysterious ways. God has different ideas.
Wilson Police Department is investigating a string of vandalisms in the West Ashley area. The incidents have been happening since Friday, including a new one that happened just today. News 2's Travis Rice has the story.
The most recent vandalism in a weekend rash of them may also be the most disturbing. The Cynthia Graham Heard Library in West Ashley is the latest site with graffiti on the walls and sidewalks. You'd think someone would know better than to deface something named after one of the Emmanuel Nine. Maintenance crews spent most of the day washing away insensitive messages.
Looks like somebody spray painted something on there.
Those just here for the books say it's something no one should have to read.
I think that's horrible. I really do. I think that's ugly and horrible.
This father says whoever did this wasn't thinking about the kids.
They learn enough as it is. They don't need it painted on the buildings.
County officials expressed their dismay at the perpetrators in a statement, saying in part, "There's no place for this sort of deplorable act in our community. Our libraries are places of education and growth for children, and will assist law enforcement in any way possible." Meanwhile, down the road, a home and a car were vandalized. Also, at the W.L. Stevens Aquatic Center, a basketball court and this storage shed were marked up with all sorts of racial slurs. Charleston police is asking for anyone with information about any of the incidents to come forward and stop the foolishness.
I just don't think that's the right thing to do.
Charleston PD is still trying to determine if all three of the incidents are related. Reporting in studio, Travis Rice, News 2.
My argument is that President Obama, whatever angst he feels, and human angst,
right,
he would likely not be president of the United States had his parents stayed together, because his father was not an immigrant. His father was a student who returned, and he would have lived a very different. So, I get it, pain.
Right.
But on the other hand, the opportunities came not so much through your black father, but through your white mama.
Yeah, we've got
white mamas for everybody. White mamas for everybody.
Thank you so much for being on So Many White Guys.
Yes!
This is very exciting. I'm a big fan of yours. I met you months ago at the L event for Marley Mag.
Marley!
So I got to do this event with you guys, and you were so sweet and so nice, and we exchanged emails, and I was like, this is really cool. so then I emailed you and asked you to do the show, and there's so much I want to talk to you about, but the first thing I want to talk to you about is, so you went to Duke University, and you majored in poli sci?
Yeah, so I got my PhD at Duke. I did my undergrad at Wake Forest.
Yes.
Got the degree in English as a college student, and then went on and got the PhD from Duke.
Yep. Yes. And your college advisor at some point was Maya Angelou.
Mm-hmm.
That's cray-cray banane. what? What is that? What was she like?
Mm.
How did this happen? What was her style?
Oh, man. And then... An hour later, you can ask question number two.
Yeah, right.
Because, so Maya Angelou taught at Wake Forest when I was there as an undergraduate student. And, I teach there now as a professor that carries her name. So my professorship is the Maya Angelou Presidential Professorship, which is...
No pressure.
Yeah, right? It's kind of every once in a while when I'm sending one of my appalling emails, I realize that her name is on the bottom. And I'm like, oops. but she was kind of everything in that she was generous and brilliant and courageous, but also so very real. You know, she would have us as students to her home. And when she did, she always cooked for us because she loved food. But, she also believed in making it herself. She often taught around her own table. She was a very hard teacher. Mm-hmm. She really assigned a lot of reading. But, I like to say that, part of how I met her was I was taking her class. And then, because you're stupid when you're 17, 18 years old, I was pledging my sorority, got bronchitis, took a medication that I had an allergic reaction to, lost my whole semester, and had to drop all my classes, including Maya Angelou's class.
Oh.
So my little 17-year-old self strode up to Maya Angelou and was like, hey, yo, I'm gonna have to drop your class. And, the appropriate response to that is, get out of my face, girl.
Right.
But what she said to me was, wait a minute, aren't you a scholarship student? How are you going to continue to progress if you drop all your classes? And, of course, I cried and said, I have no idea. And her response to that was, well, why don't you come work for me this summer? I'll pay your tuition this summer to take classes to catch up, and you can work it off by being my student assistant. And that was the summer of the 92 presidential election when Bill Clinton won. And then that January, she gave the inaugural poem, and I was answering her fan mail after she gave on the Pulse of Morning, and I had a chance to see what happens when a black woman addresses the nation and how she helped to change the world. And it changed my life. It was an extraordinary experience.
That could be a movie. Like my summer, seriously, My Summer with Maya. And it's just that's fucking amazing. A whole summer?
Oh, no. I mean, not for the rest of my college, for 2 years.
That is amazing.
Yeah, it was great. Wow.
Okay. So what do you think was the biggest lesson you learned from your time with her?
Yeah, I think I'd have to say two. Mm-hmm. One is courage is the most important virtue because without courage, you can't practice any of the other virtues consistently. So she says, you can be anything, you can be good at anything, but you can't be that thing consistently unless you're courageous. And the other is I am human, and therefore nothing human can be alien to me. And this one is both tough, but very powerful. So You have to remember, of course, Maya Angelou was a survivor of childhood rape. Mm-hmm. And so when she says, I am human and therefore nothing human can be alien to me, she would encourage us as students, she'd say, when someone does something horrible, you are not allowed to say that that person is a monster. So I think about, for example, Dylann Roof. Mm. You're not allowed to say Dylann Roof is a monster. You have to acknowledge that he's human. And anything a human can do, you can do. So you have to acknowledge that the horror that Dylann Roof did in Charleston, South Carolina, you have that in you. The only reason you don't do it is because you nurture a different intention. Mm. But you're not actually different. You just nurture a different intention. And it's important that you acknowledge that, because otherwise, if you lose sight of that, you could turn into that. It's also true with anything that's good. Any wonderful, beautiful, brilliant, fabulous thing that any human has done, you are capable of. I mean, it doesn't mean you can, like, be Michael Jordan or, like, you know, but you're capable of greatness or of horror because you're human. I take it very seriously in my own work and in my own teaching, mm-hmm. and I try, even though I'm a highly judgmental and snarky person, mm-hmm. to pause, come back, and try to remember that.
Yeah, it's hard to do that, I think, given this political climate that we live in, to see the humanity in some people who are actively trying to prevent people from living their best lives, their most full lives, even like being this country. So how do you reconcile that with like what's going on right now?
You know, I had a really incredible 2016 relative to politics. I got to spend 2016 with these 30 students traveling from Iowa to the inauguration, and they were Democrats and Republicans. Mm-hmm. And we went to every single event and worked for every single candidate and saw the whole thing very, very, very up close. And I had always known that Hillary was going to lose the election.
Really? What makes you say that?
The shortest version of this answer that I can give that will make sense is simply that there are a number of indicators that as an empirical political scientist, I could look at and say, everything tells me that this candidate is an extraordinarily weak candidate, and nothing that was going on in 2016 in her campaign seemed to address the most central weaknesses that I could see that existed as far back as 2004.
Oh, wow. Okay.
And we knew that they existed in 2008 because she lost in a primary in 2008 to a candidate who I like to say was named Osama bin Laden and had been on the school board in Chicago the year before. Now, when America elects a black guy named Osama bin Laden instead of you, and then 8 years later, you old and a woman, I mean, like, I don't, like, I mean, I'm being light, but, like, America don't like women.
Right.
Maybe y'all had noticed that this year.
Yeah. I mean, we've known for a long time, but I think for a while people were, because I think a lot of people were shocked at, like, especially how many white women voted for Trump, and I was like, no one likes women.
Let's be clear. Mm-hmm. People mad at the white ladies for voting for the Trump. But I want to just, white women have not voted in a majority for the Democrats since the 1960s. Mm. Why would anyone be surprised? Like, I'm sorry. Is someone unconscious? Now, ordinary folks wandering around, paying their bills, taking their kids to school. Cool. You don't know. I ain't mad at you. That's fine. That's your business. I don't expect you to know. But the hell with the Democratic Party don't know. Is there a reason why professionals working for the Democratic Party were unaware that white women have not voted for the Democrat since the 1960s? Is someone there incapable of running a crosstab that would show you that white women have not? This is your actual job.
I mean, talking right now, I'm like, I think you should be a political advisor. I think you should like run.
What I saw was that the Democratic Party decided to take their party back. Everybody was over here worried about the Republicans being racist. And what I saw was that whiteness stood its ground in the Democratic Party. Mm. What I saw, and I might be wrong because I am often wrong. Mm-hmm. I'm wrong a lot. My 15-year-old points this out to me pretty often.
But what I saw happen was a party that relies on black and brown voters make a decision to exclusively run one candidate. And then, you know, Bernie Sanders, who's not a Democrat, chose to run from the outside. But even then, a party whose entire base and even its fringes really is black, brown and young people had a primary between two old white people. I saw whiteness standing its ground in a party so determined to once again say, oh, no, we're the real America. We're white. We're white working class. That even when it lost its ass to a reality TV star for having done it, the next morning woke up and said, oh, man, we better go back and get those white guys. That their inability, incapacity, and unwillingness to see the leadership in black and brown and young folks is its own undoing. I said, boy, bye to the Democratic Party. I unsubscribed from their little email list. I went and registered my damn self as an independent.
Yes, I've been independent for like 10 years.
I just cannot. So they want to be white. They're going to just have to wipe that on up right over there. I cannot.
Okay, so I want to go back because you mentioned MSNBC and you had your own show on there for 4 years. Yep. Do you want to kind of refresh listeners' memory as to why you decided to leave the show? Because I thought it was a very brave move.
Yes. So I wrote a letter to my staff because I had not been invited to host my own show for weeks. I wrote a letter to my staff explaining why, after having not been invited to host my own show for weeks, when I finally was invited to host the hours when my show appeared, I was not accepting the invitation. Mm-hmm. It was because it was not going to be my show. It was just going to be the hours of my show. The letter that I wrote to my staff was leaked to the New York Times, but only a portion of the letter. Mm-hmm. Because the portion that was leaked was racially inflammatory, I then leaked the entire letter to a friend and former producer, and he put it on Medium. After that, NBC made the decision to fire me. Mm-hmm. So I didn't make the decision to leave my show.
Yeah.
They made a decision to fire me. So when we got to the bargaining table at the end of that whole process, there's kind of a conversation that you have where, you know, what they do is they hold the rest of your contract over your head. And they're like, well, you can either take the rest of your contract in money. And if you take it, then you can never talk about any of this, or we'll keep your money. And if you ever talk about any of this, you know, that's fine, but you'll never have any of this money. And so I said, keep your damn money. And it liberated me to be able to talk about it.
Wow. That's amazing. So you're at Wake Forest and you're teaching a class right now. What's the name of it again?
So the class I'm teaching right now, I'm co-teaching with my colleague, Dr. Danny Parker, and it's a class on girls' stories. And we're looking at girls of color and the ways that their storytelling is both pedagogy and politics.
So when you created this class, was this always the intention, like when you decided to go back and do this sort of program there, were you like your mission was to highlight voices for women and people of color, or did it just kind of like you wake up in the middle of the night like, oh, this is what I should be doing?
Well, so, you know, I never left the academy. TV was always the best side hustle ever. It was a well-paid side hustle. It was a little exhausting because I was working 7 days a week for a while and flying back and forth like Tom Joyner. But I was always a college professor, so there was never like a going back. And my work has always been on race and politics, but has become increasingly about girls and women, maybe in part because my oldest daughter, like the more I watch her become a young woman, like the more invested I am in like she won't talk to me. So maybe I'm like talk to other young women. But I think also just for me, theoretically, it's been like I always caught and understood and have a lot to say about my blackness. But I guess I was surprised at how long it took me and how long it took other people to think it was important for me to have something to say about the intersection of my race and gender. Mm. And I still find that to be so true. Like, I'll tell the story real fast. When I went to see Hidden Figures, I was so pissed with my uncle, who spent a lot of years as the head of aeronautical engineering at MIT mm-hmm. and worked at, you know, at NASA. And I called him and I was like, Uncle Wes, do you know the story of these women? He was like, oh, yeah. And I was like, hey, sir, you know, like, you have two daughters, you know, he's my dad's twin brother. There are, you know, are four girls in our family. Mm-hmm. I was like, you know, y'all spent, my dad and his mother are real, like, radical black, right?
Yeah.
And I was like, you know, y'all spent a lot of time with this, like, radical black shit. Like, y'all taught us everything. We know all the names. Yeah. I mean, I spent a lot of time on this. I was like, but you never thought you should tell us the girl stories?
Yeah.
He was like, oh, yeah, I guess. What? I was so pissed. I was so mad that they never felt like they needed to give us mm-hmm. the black women's stories, too. And so I think that's part of it for me is, like, that specificity matters a lot.
Yeah, we get left out of the conversation a lot. And, like, our contributions tend to get glazed over. And, yeah, it's kind of frustrating when that happens all the time because you're like, how much do I not know about my own history? I was in Pittsburgh recently because New York Times did this month-long series about, like, sending different writers to different stops on the Underground Railroad. So, like, I went to Pittsburgh, and there was just, like, all this stuff that I didn't know because it just wasn't taught in schools. It was just like, yeah, Pittsburgh, like, a lot of, like, runaways, like, passed through Pittsburgh, and, like, that's all I knew. And then I went and, like, saw these different, like, houses, and, like, I was just like, oh, my God, I know, like, American history literally is just white history. Mm-hmm. So your parents, interracial couple in the 70s, they were both educators. Mm-hmm. Is that what inspired you to be an educator too? And what was it like growing up with such, like, really smart and active, like, socially active parents?
All right. So let's be clear. They were not like a couple. Like, they was round, both of them, mm-hmm. and they were both in my life, but the idea of them as a couple, I was like, they were a couple? Like, you saw me kind of look yeah. at you like, what?
And I was like, am I not saying things
yeah, you
correctly?
Know, I was like imagining my parents as a couple. I was like, that, damn, I guess at some point, sure. Uh-huh, right. Yep. We were a family.
Yes.
Of complicated sort.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, there you go. So, but we were a big, crazy, quirky family. My father is a very intense race man. Mm-hmm. He grew up Jim Crow South, was college roommates with Stokely Carmichael. You know, he and his twin brother were like, you know, like the first to go to college in their families. Both of them became college professors. My dad was like the first dean of Afro-American Affairs,
wow.
you know, at the University of Virginia. Like, you know, I still run into people who were his student and they're like, you know, oh, Dean Harris, yo, you're Dean Harris's daughter. You know, like, that's who my dad was.
Yeah.
He would give us birthday. I'm the youngest of five. And he'd give you birthday cards, $1 for every year. Right. So mm-hmm. like if you were six, you get $6.
Mm-hmm.
Right. $40.
Yeah.
Like straight up. Like, you know how much money you get right now. You know
yeah.
exactly how many dollars you will be getting. Right. And then always sign the card the same way. The struggle continues. Daddy.
Oh, I love that.
Yeah, well, but when you're five, you're like, what the hell?
Yeah, that means nothing to you.
The struggle continues. Okay? So that's like that. So that's who my daddy is.
Mm-hmm.
My mother is a white woman who grew up in the Pacific Northwest mm-hmm. in a Latter-day Saints family.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Yeah, see, now your face is doing yeah. it, right? You're like, oh! White. Right. Like, so her people.
So how did they meet?
Yeah. Okay. Right. So yeah, I'm coming. So like her people pushed hand carts across the American West. Like they came from England following Brigham Young. Right.
Mm-hmm.
But she went to Brigham Young University and graduated and wrote, you know, stories about Mormon womanhood. But then she left the church and she was in graduate school when she met my dad. And she was his TA in a stats class.
That's cute.
Yeah. And then those two people moved yeah. to Virginia in the 70s.
Yeah. Oh, boy.
Yeah, right. I also was not raised to be interracial. I was black.
Really? Okay, let's talk about that. Because my niece she's interracial. She's half white, half black. And I think we're like, yeah, you're both. But so was this a choice you made or a choice your parents made? Or a
it
combination?
It was the 70s. It was a choice America made.
Yeah, yeah.
Because, I mean, how would you look being like, what? You interracial? No, baby.
Yeah.
Because it was 1975, and we lived, like, immediately post Loving v. Virginia, mm-hmm. in Virginia, with the white Mormon mama and the black daddy from, you know, Stokely Carmichael. Talking about struggle continues.
Yeah.
And my mother was a sociologist who wrote books like How to Have Intercourse Without Getting Fucked, about STDs. Yes. Mm-hmm.
That's amazing.
Yeah. Oh, amazing. And so while my daddy was like, struggle continues, here's $6. My mama was like, here's a mirror. You should always know your own pussy better than anyone else.
That is so cool.
Yes. That was my household.
But so the 70s decided that you were black and not interracial. So like how did your mom ever have any sort of feelings about
She's
you?
She's white.
Like, I know. But
She's
still,
white.
I know.
What the fuck does she need to have a feeling about? The motherfucker is white in America. She's fine.
I know, but do you,
she's
I'm
white
wondering.
In America. She, I. So I think it's different if we're talking yeah. about two. I'll have a very different perspective if you're talking about like Southeast Asian and Latino. So if your parents are both from marginal racial minority categories, mm-hmm. then I think those are different kinds of choices. But if one of the parents is white,
yeah.
Nah.
Yeah.
They gonna get who don't get whiteness?
Yeah.
But you got to teach them whiteness because then they might miss it?
No, I know. But I was wondering maybe she like because you chose to identify as black. I didn't know if she like maybe felt like she wanted you to also identify both sides. I don't know. I'm just asking.
Because you might grow up in America and miss whiteness. You might accidentally miss White History Month.
That's true.
Since my point is like, yeah. you never need to reinforce whiteness.
Yeah.
Because whiteness is so powerfully reinforced, mm-hmm. you never need to reinforce it. So don't do that to your kids. That is you having white woman tears on your kids. Don't do that shit. Go do that shit in the corner.
Can we put that on a magnet, white woman tears on your kids? That's amazing.
Don't do it. Don't do that to your child.
So did they inspire you to become an educator or no?
Oh, right. That was the question.
Yes, that was
the question. Yes. Yeah, I've read a lot of books to escape. Yeah, I mean, maybe they did. You know, again, I'm the youngest of five. None of the rest of the family are educators in the most classic sense. Mm-hmm. But I think, I mean, everybody's a talker. Everybody's a reader. So I will say, yeah, I think all of us are educators in one way or another.
Yeah. And I want to go back because we got to wrap up. But I want to go back to because you have a 15-year-old daughter. She's very exciting. Or not. I don't know. I was kind of a monster when I was a teenager. She could be great.
She's a monster great. She's a great asshole monster. She's one. I mean, she is the fulfillment of that great parental curse. May you have a child like yourself.
Mm-hmm.
So I have two children.
Yes.
I have a 3-year-old.
Yes.
And I have a 15-year-old. Mm-hmm. They are very different from each other.
Right.
So my 3-year-old is real super black.
You have a militant 3-year-old?
Oh, yeah.
I love that.
My 3-year-old is so super militant black mm-hmm. that her preschool teachers thought that she was autistic. They thought that she could not speak
mm-hmm.
because she never spoke to them because she doesn't talk to white people.
And where did she learn that by chance?
I talk to white people all the time. No.
You were the hubby. Who did it?
We both talk to white people all day long. If I didn't talk to white people, I would be mute. I talk to white folks. I don't know why my child don't talk to white people.
Yeah.
She apparently for a year and a half went to school and didn't so much as say good morning. She was like, and then came home and chatted up all the words to her black childcare provider, to us. But in school, it was just like,
I love that.
Yeah, it's a lot. I mean, she would go to swim class and she didn't like the swimming teacher and she'd just lay back and put her head so the water would come up over her ears and not listen to her. She's a lot. So that's a 3-year-old and her sense of self is all together. She has her whole entire life mm-hmm. and self-concept and blackness together.
Yeah.
She's good.
Yeah.
Now the 15-year-old, so remember, what do you do at 15? You rebel.
Mm-hmm.
You rebel against your parents.
you particularly rebel against the parent you are most like. So how might one rebel against MHP?
I would just only listen to like Lady Antebellum and Taylor Swift.
Yes, ma'am.
Okay. A final question is, because you have such a light about you, you just radiate such positivity. So what are you hopeful for in this upcoming year for the country, for yourself, and for your family?
Well, here's really where I am with the country.
Mm-hmm.
Donald Trump is a meaningful problem for the nation. And the Trump administration is a meaningful problem. But I think we have to be very sober about the fact that an end to a Trump administration, which will happen at some point, mm-hmm. 4 years, 8 years, is not an end to the sets of problems that the Trump administration represents.
Mm-hmm.
Again, if we were to go back to the Dylann Roof example, Dylann Roof is going to die in a gas chamber in South Carolina at some point, most likely. When he dies, white supremacy and white supremacist violence will not die with him.
Yeah.
And if we were to believe that it would, and that our solution to the problem of white supremacy and white supremacist violence is to kill Dylann Roof in a South Carolina gas chamber, then we'd be pretty deeply confused about what the work is. And so the Trump administration is potentially the greatest teacher that we have about what our country is,
mm-hmm.
about who we are. I think it was First Lady Obama who said that the presidency is a great revealer. It tells you what the character of the person holding the office is. But she may have been a little wrong, just that it's less about the character of the person holding the office is and more about who the country is.
Mm-hmm.
This presidency will reveal who we are.
Okay, that's good. That's kind of hopeful. Yeah.
Sure. Yes!
Well, Melissa, thank you so much for being here. You're an absolute delight. I could talk to you for like 7 years and not get bored.
Oh, no, you get bored eventually.
All right, bye.
Bye.
Context of White Supremacy, Gus T. Renegade, in for another broadcast, hopefully to share constructive information on the system of white supremacy. Today's date, Saturday, March 18th, 2017. So I have been told. Happy birthday, Dr. Welsing. Compensatory call-in. Folks have commentary they would like to share. News, events, sound clips that you heard at the beginning of the program. Dial in the number 641-715-3640. The code is 564-943 pound. Press star 6 if you would like to participate. That number again, 641-715-3640. The code is 564-943 pound. Press star 6 if you would like to participate, especially if we have any folks who were fortunate to participate in the ceremony for Dr. Welsing this evening. Sabrina Johnson, she was one of the folks that helped put things together. It was in Washington, D.C. at the Thurgood Marshall Center. I've read about it previously since the time that I was first informed that this was going to happen. If any of our listeners got the chance to participate live in person, certainly chime in and let us know what you observed, who spoke, just your thoughts and observations from the event. If we have any folks who were able to participate, if maybe you dial in next week. If we don't hear from folks who participated this week, perhaps you can dial in next Saturday for the compensatory call-in and share what you observed. Right on. Before we get to callers, number one, we are listener-supported Counter Racist Radio. If you would like to invest, you can visit my blog, racism-notes.blogspot.com. racism-notes.blogspot.com. When you hit the blog, look in the top right corner. You'll see our PayPal button. If you are not into PayPal, drop me an email and we will get you a physical mailing address, untiljustice@gmail.com. Huge thanks to all the folks who have supported, people who have got us items off the wish list at Amazon.com under Gus T. Renegade. Thanks to people who have nabbed items there and just contributed, supported, shared the program with other victims of racism. Hope it has been, continues to be worthy of your time and energy. Helps folks get a better understanding of what racism, white supremacy is, how it works. With that, a couple things I wanted to share. Before we get started, number one, we had a listener who went to see the god-awful production Get Out. I have seen it. Who went to see it, they wrote a counter-racist review. I'm going to skip to what I thought was the best part of the review. Before I get to that, I do want to share, number one, Dr. Cambon and myself, among others, have strongly advocated not going to the movies just as a strategy of counter-racist economics, time and energy, and my nickels. If you think I'm fixing to give you a nickel, a pecan, anything, to go and watch Get Out or Empire, got a cable, right, Netflix, you are outside your mind. And even time and energy, that is real important under conditions of white supremacy. Given all of the problems facing black people, I mean, we should really be thinking, do I have 90 minutes to waste to see anything? That notwithstanding, if, you know, people, a part of their code is I'm going to go to the movies, you know, for whatever reason, forget Gus, fine. I would not encourage going to late showings. This person in their review said that they went with their wife and they went to, I think, the latest showing at their local theater. I just would not encourage that. Dr. Cambon, again, he said, kind of suggest that we maybe take it easy on being out late. I think he would say late is after 10 p.m., 11 p.m. At night, just saying under conditions of white supremacy, frequently bad things happen to black people when it gets dark. Police encounters, other victims of racism, anything, race soldiers, anything. So that would be, you know, a good suggestion, in my opinion, to not hit the late. In fact, I can tell you the last time that I went to a late showing, I think I've gone to a late showing at a max two times in the last decade. And when I went, we had a code about what to do. In fact, I went with a victim. I went with three people. All of us had read Mr. Fuller's book. All of us understand racism, white supremacy. We talked about what we were going to do if anything happened, because we went on a Friday at the latest showing, so we already anticipated. And this was before the shooting at the theater in Colorado in 2012. But we discussed, you know, what could possibly happen. You know, if something goes wrong, if they're rowdy whites, we're going to do this, we're going to do that. All of this was planned before we even got to the theater. We had a discussion about all of this. I'm not saying you have to do that, but I'm just saying this is the system of racism, white supremacy, and bad things happen to black people all the time. To the movie review, they write, so I'm skipping what they said about the film, blah, 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 blah. Okay. After leaving the movie theaters, the energy felt very tense from the suspected racists. There were whites sitting close by in the theater who were griping about various portions of the film. Damn Obama, that sort of thing. Okay, so continuing. We got to our car quickly, black male, black female, they're married, and briefly spoke about the movie when we noticed a group of young white men staring at us from their car to the left of us. They got out of their car, and that is when we attempted to drive away. One of them jumped on the car and started slamming his fist on the trunk and running after us as we drove away. At this moment, there was nothing we could do but drive away. As good as the movie was, reality still remains the same. Whites can do whatever they want to the black body with impunity. Why else would a group of young white men, early 20s, feel comfortable terrorizing us while we were in our car after a film that probably challenged their evil nature and their authority over non-whites, specifically blacks, on this planet? I am glad that I did not let emotions get the best of me, or else I would have gotten out of the car and this could have been another tragic, deadly encounter with a group of savage whites. There you go. White people are dangerous. Next, Dr. Welsing, her birthday today. I remember talking with her, and I think I had shared this before in a previous program. We were talking, not in a gossipy, disparaging way, about Melissa Harris Perry. I think I just mentioned something that was on her program when she had her show on MSNBC for about 4 years. I mentioned it to Dr. Welsing, and she said, I just have a hard time watching her show because they're dancing around, or she specifically, Miss Harris Perry, she's Mrs. Harris Perry, she's dancing around and it just doesn't seem serious. That was what she said specifically. It just doesn't seem serious, and I just have a hard time watching the show. And then she said that, and even the way that the show is presented when it was on, that they called her Melissa. They had her name, Melissa, first name, in big letters, and that was how Melissa. Melissa, Melissa, she said, when they have that gay white female on the show, her name is just escaping me for the moment because I don't watch her show. But she said when they have her on, they do not just focus on her first name. It's Rachel Maddow. That's who it is. It's Maddow. That's what they have up in big letters. Not her first name. It's not Rachel. It's not Rachel emblazoned. I would have to look to see if that's the same. But I remember at the time when we discussed this, that this was true. And she just said that to her signifies the difference. Even though, yeah, Melissa Harris Perry, she's got her doctorate, big time professor, you publish books and all this, you're still a nigger, and we're going to show our disrespect towards you. And even, you know, playing into why she ultimately left the show. I found that interview fascinating for a number of reasons. Number one, when I heard it, I just kept thinking, you know, who is this person and what have you done with MHP? Like, this does not sound like the Melissa Harris Perry that I heard on her show. And I mean, hey, I didn't see everyone. She was on for 4 years. Wasn't my favorite bit of viewing, but I did watch it pretty consistently. She did not sound like that when she had her show on MSNBC. I've heard her on other outlets. I've seen her on Bill Maher, like recently. She was on Bill Maher for the whole election season. She did not sound like that. I've never heard her curse before, ever. And Bill Maher curses all the time. You can curse on that show. She was not cursing and speaking like that, even on his show. That was one. Out of many reasons, I was just stunned as I was listening to when she was talking about Hillary Clinton, and she said, you know, we don't like women. You know, y'all didn't know. We don't like women. That's the second time that I've heard her give that sentiment. The first time that I heard her do this was back at the end of 2014 when they released that ungodly fabrication, the Rolling Stone report saying that white woman Jackie was raped and it was terrible. And then they had to retract the whole thing. Sabrina Erdley, another suspected race soldier, some white woman lying, and with a whole report that they had to retract. I hope the University of Virginia bankrolls the Rolling Stone trying to make my alma mater look bad. But she had Sabrina Erdley on the program before the story got retracted. And oh, man, those white women got up there and went in like, yeah, right, right, right. But Melissa Harris Perry, she came out strong. She put bass on her voice, and you cannot look at the world and come to any other conclusion that the world doesn't like women, or the country doesn't like women. I'm paraphrasing, but it doesn't like women, period. On the segment and right on, everybody on the set, right on, right on, right on. I've never heard Melissa Harris Perry at any point, and she has VGQ, but I'm just pointing this out. I've heard her say repeatedly and have people on her panel say where she doesn't challenge it, where it seems she's endorsing, agreeing, we don't like women. I've never heard her say, we don't like black people. America doesn't like black people, even though that's incorrect. But I've never heard that. White people don't like black people. Never. And the context when she had Sabrina Erdley on in 2014 was right after no indictment for Michael Brown, Tamir Rice shooting, no indictment for Eric Garner. And no time. Now, maybe I missed it. If somebody can pull it out, feel free. But I just found that striking. I like to contrast the way that people talk about, you know, what they view as different forms of oppression, just seeing if anything stands out as significant. For me, that is one that's significant. If anyone, you know, can tell me, hey, Gus, you have missed some of Melissa Harris Perry's other segments where she's been more truthful, share, and I'll play it on the program. One last thing that I'll get in that stood out to me significantly. I have said consistently, I think I've said this before with Michelle Alexander. She wrote The New Jim Crow about what they call mass incarceration, racism, white supremacy. She has a white parent. I think that's significant. Same thing with Melissa Harris Perry. She has a white parent. I think that is hugely significant. And the other thing that kept weighing on my mind was her father, dean at my alma mater. I did not meet him while I was there. Her father could not have been that radical if, you know, I feel like I can just fade that on out to a cowbell and we'll leave it there. We will get to the callers. The number again is 641-715-3640 and the code is 564-943-pound. Press star 6 if you would like to participate. First few people that dialed in with a hand up, before I get to your line, no metaphors. You could speak directly, explicitly to whatever topic you want to address. That would be super appreciated. And then if you could take about 5 minutes to share whatever views, commentary you have, make sure that everybody gets at least one opportunity to speak. Again, no metaphors. I will prompt about that. Speak directly to what you want to say. Now, the first few people who dialed in with a hand up, line should be open. Feel free to participate.
Can I be heard? Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Greetings, Gus. Rest of the callers and the listeners on the line. It's Rob in Milwaukee.
Your volume is a little low. If you could speak up, that would be helpful.
Can you hear me now?
Just make sure you keep your voice up. Lots of black self-respect. Speak up.
Okay. First, clips. 70% revisited. 70% of people returning to prison. I think he said it was about 35% that actually stay out. That was significant for me. I did 8 years on parole, and I did not return to greater confinement, so that stood out. One more thing that I wrote down. The Melissa Harris Perry clip, I was stunned as well. At her voice, choice of language. I was really disgusted at what her white mom said, and she repeated. I was just looking a little funny when that was said. As far as the week, like I said, I've been dealing with health issues. So Friday I had a doctor's appointment with the neurologist. Non-white neurologist, very dark complexion, Indian descent. He had a very gentle demeanor. And out of the whole time that I've been suffering with this injury, this is the first physician that really examined me, and I asked him to watch me while I contort my face back into place, and through him watching me, he ordered an MRI for my face and my brain, and I could be in error, but if you need an MRI on your face and your brain, man, you got to be pretty injured. And it's been an emotionally hard week because I realized that the black women that I've had in my life have been toxic, and I've had to disconnect from them for my mental well-being, because this physical injury is taking me to a place that I have never been before. And I've been in prison for 5 years at the age of 18 years old, and that does not compare to the pain that I experience every day. So I had to call the woman who gave biological birth to me and calmly explain to her that that if she see me on the street or anywhere that she see me, to not to speak to me, because I will not speak to her. And that's including my auntie and my grandmother. My grandmother, due to whatever reason, her husband at the time, which is my uncle's father, raped my mother as a little child. And my mother has been dysfunctional to this day, and they don't allow my mom to talk about that. And my family injured me in this manner, and they expect me to take the same position that my mom take, and I will not do it because I'm physically disabled. And while I've been going through this physical disability, my grandmother said to me, oh boy, that happened a long time ago. My auntie said to me, well, you know, Rob, everybody's health is fucked up right now. Excuse my language. And my mom said to me, oh boy, that ain't even how you get no boil on your face. You know, especially when you contorting your face like that. And, you know, I really just realized that I don't have a lot of good people around me. And good people that I do have around me are on this network. Shout out to Mr. Scotty Reed. That Friday, when I was very emotional, and I called Scotty Reed, and Scotty called me back and allowed me to vent what I was going through. And, you know, if I wouldn't have found this network, I would have been sitting with that emotional pain. And the last thing that I want to share, my son's birthday just passed, March 16th. He turned 12 years old. And, you know, I'm up at 5 in the morning every morning. And his mom is a chef by trade. She sells dinners, so before his birthday, she reached out to me to sell something. I patronized the business. So the day of his birthday, 6 in the morning, I call. I don't get a response. I call back 7:30, 7, you know, keep calling, and I still don't get a response. And I'm not getting a response because I'm not able to financially do anything for my son. Thank you for listening. I mute my line.
Thank you for sharing. The system of racism, white supremacy does produce just lots and lots of really toxic relationships amongst non-white people, particularly black people, but amongst non-white people, amongst everybody, because this is not about justice. So very sorry to hear that. Yeah, minimize contact is in the code book. Other folks that we have not heard from, if you have a hand up, line should be open. Feel free.
May I be heard?
Yes, ma'am.
Good evening, Beth, to the callers and listeners. This is a caller from Michigan. Just wanted to say to the previous caller, definitely want to keep him listed in our prayers and just kind of, you know, understand, just like you said, Gus, the system of racism, white supremacy, just produces toxic relationships. And just, you know, we have to try to take as best care of ourselves physically as best possible. As it relates to the clips, I did make notification of, I think there was a clip about, I guess there was some racial slurs or vandalism at a library. And it just caught my attention the way they were describing the incident. And I just appreciate, you know, just understanding now how important it is to the word choices that we use to describe racism, or just, you know, just being very specific about our word choices to describe what we're trying to say. And so when I was listening to the clip, they were interviewing, I guess, other white people or who appeared to be white people about the incident. And it sounded like to me, I think I could be incorrect, but it sounded like one of the people interviewed was saying, you know, they need to stop this foolishness, which was, you know, the vandalism. And I looked at that like, wow, that wouldn't be the most accurate term to describe racial slurs being spray painted on the, you know, buildings or the library. I kind of came in towards the end, so I wasn't sure. But that would be, in my opinion, that's a hate crime. And I looked up the definition of a hate crime, you know, it was saying vandalism, intimidating words on property. That's a hate crime. So they should stop the, you know, practicing racism. They should stop, you know, committing hate crimes and overall terrorism. But to me, foolishness to say to stop this foolishness wasn't accurate. So I just try to pay more attention to words. The other thing I want to say, and I mentioned this on Thursday, if anyone has any codified way that they tip, I know I'm trying to minimize any or stop overall any helping of white people, but I do find myself having to tip for services that, you know, that are waitresses, waiters, things like that. And I just want to know if anyone has a codified way of how they handle that, because I do tip very well with black people, but I'm conflicted or just going through like some thoughts on how I should tip when my server is white or something like that. Just wanted to get your response.
All right. I do remember you asking about that on workplace racism. I just wanted to get in. That wasn't just a library that was subjected to racist vandalism. That was the Cynthia Graham Hurd Library that was terrorized. That library was named after her because she was one of Dylan Storm Roof's victims at Mother Emanuel AME Church. Just very important which library this was that was attacked. Now, the tipping part. Again, my code, I encourage, you know, we should try to minimize, if not totally eliminate, eating out at white establishments or what have you. Go eat out, eat at a black, you know, business, what have you. If you got to eat out at a white place and tip, I mean, you're not required to tip. I know at some places gratuity is included, but if it's not, I would say they definitely cannot get, I think, like 15 to 20%. That is like the upper end range of what is recommended. They definitely could not get that. If it's a white person, I would say that's just code. They cannot get that. And if it's going to be any over tipping or write it, you know, what the standard is, they have to be below that, I would think. And I mean, since it's not required, I might even say, hey, maybe we should challenge ourselves. One of those should be at least a zero. Like, I don't know how often people eat out. We can get other people's thoughts on this. But I mean, if you eat out 10 times a year at a white establishment where you might have a white server, you'd be tipping a white person. Man, at least I would think as many as possible, but at least one or two of those need to be zero, because you're not required to tip. And I mean, hey, this is war. Racism, white supremacy is war. That would be my view, if you got to eat out at all. Other people, I would appreciate hearing your thoughts on that as well. People, we have... Yes.
I agree with you guys, and to the other callers and the listeners. To answer the lady's question, for me, I do my darndest if I do eat out to only eat at black establishments. If they're not black establishments, non-white establishments, as far as that's my code. If I happen to eat in a place that has white service, because even if I end up there, and that's usually because my wife might choose a place and she knows what my code is, so usually she tries to align herself with my code. But sometimes she'll just have that overarching feminine presence that a wife will have, and she'll say, hey, I want to go here. And because I don't eat out often as it is, so I make that something that I do very rare. But if I do go out with her sometimes, because we don't see each other very often due to the situation with my in-laws, so when if we do go out together and we're at an establishment where we're being served by a white person, I give them the minimal tip possible. And like you said, in some cases I won't give a tip at all, especially if their service is subpar. Not saying that just subpar as far as how I'm receiving it, then they really might not get a tip at all. And that's something both myself and my wife do. So that's my code, and I agree with what your code is as far as what you said, Gus. No problems for me on that, no pushback. I think you sound like we're in line with one another on that. So that's my answer to that question. Just to speak to the issue Rob brought up about, and you discussed as well in regards to our families. Man, my family is just completely annihilated by the system of white supremacy. I have one sister. It's just her and I. We don't speak. My mother and I haven't spoken since 2003, and ever since I was about, I would say 17. It started when I was 7 years old, but she started kicking me out of the house at 11. So we have had these off and on non-speaking periods where we won't speak for 5, 6 years, and then all of a sudden we speak for a couple, then we fall out. And the most recent time was 2003, and I said that's the last time I'm going to deal with anything to do with her at this point. And I'm still open if she makes any attempts at wanting to reconcile with me. I'm open to that, but I'm not looking for that. I don't need a parent at this point. I'm taking care of my son. That's all that matters. My father and I haven't spoken in an extremely long time since about 2008, and we've had long periods of not speaking to one another as well. So I know exactly what he's speaking of, and it's tough, but it's something sometimes you just have to do it. I agree with Neely Fuller. Minimize contact to minimize conflict. That's something that I live by. That's something that I practice. And sadly enough, I have to practice it with the people who should matter most to me. But that's just life. You know, you have to do what you have to do. I'm trying to make sure that my branch of the family tree is a counter-racist, less confused branch. And I've done so by collecting as much information, knowledge, books, CDs, DVDs, on the information that's necessary to elevate the consciousness of my descendants. And my son understands that it's his job to build on that library once I pass away. So that's my answer to the system of white supremacy based on my life experience. To get to the clips, I found the clip about the Cynthia Grand Library. But there was a white woman who said that this sort of behavior would not be tolerated in our town, and how the library representative wanted to do as much as they could to help police arrest these people. As far as I'm concerned with that, the only reason these things happen is because the culture of this society is understood to be a white supremacist one. If these things were not understood, these things would not happen. So the idea of her even saying that is an oxymoron and an act of racism in and of itself. People do things that are permissible in their society. And when you have a hierarchy of white supremacy, white people know they can get away with anything. So that's what they're doing, what white people do. And again, they're just using the media to foster confusion amongst non-white people to the fact that all white people are racist, as far as that clip is concerned. I wanted to say rest in peace to Chuck Berry. He died today at 90 years old. I don't believe any black people that die, even if they die at 90 years old with a smile on their face. I think every black person is a murder victim until the system has been replaced, and that includes, sadly, Chuck Berry, though he lived a long time. The clip about King Kong and Sam Jackson, I found it interesting in the commercial. He says, we're going to show him that man is king. And I find that interesting, and an obfuscation to use him because black males are not considered men, first of all, and we have been historically called apes for as long as we come into contact with white people. So I just find that to be an oxymoron to put him in that position of this white, I mean, this black hunter of this King Kong character to obfuscate the reality of the fact that black people are represented by King Kong. And then, of course, he would be looked at as a sub King Kong, fighting another big King Kong as far as the way the system of white supremacy would look at him. So I find that whole movie to be just nauseating. And lastly, I just wanted to share a workplace racism incident that happened to me yesterday. I just think it's poignant. I have a coworker, a white woman, married to an African from Kenya. I've talked about her on the show before and the fact that she's a racist white supremacist and has basically kidnapped this black male from his family and now has him cordoned off with a white racist family. And ultimately, she had a newborn child. The child is now 5 months old by this African male. And he's such a handsome kid, and I feel so sorry that he has to be born to a racist rapist. But ultimately, she said something that blew my mind. She said to me, we were talking, and she said, let me show you some pictures of him because he just turned 5 months and he's growing so fast. So she showed me these pictures, and he's just a beautiful young man. Looks just like his father, just a light-skinned version of his dad. And ultimately, she said, I feel kind of weird doing this, but it's the best analogy I can think of. And she's compared her own child to a dog. She said, I said, well, he's so happy, smiling in those pictures. He just seems to be a really happy kid. And she said, when I said that, it feels weird to say this, but you know how when you come home from work, no matter what your disposition is, that your dog is always happy to see you? She said, it's almost like that. That's how happy he is. And I looked at her and I was like, wow. You are literally, I've never heard any white person compare a white child by a white man to a dog. But yet this woman who's in a tragic arrangement is comparing her child by a black male to a dog. I've never even heard black people compare their children to dogs. So to look at her do that, it just blew my mind. But again, it didn't blow my mind in the sense that I understand she's a white supremacist. And even though she has this.
5 minutes.
Sorry, my bad.
No apologies. We will circle back around. I'm sure we'll have more time for you to finish up. All the other folks who have a hand up that we've not heard from, did you have commentary?
Can I hear you? Yes.
We'll get the female caller first.
Greetings, everybody. This is Emmy. I'm so happy to call in. I missed all of the clips. But it's because I went to the tribute for Dr. Francis Kress Welsing. So I just wanted to share that with you all. And I kind of geeked. I totally geeked because in one of it was very nice. It was packed. Lots of people, and they had children who, you know, read poetry and essays. It was very nice. Spoke about Mr. Neely Fuller Jr.'s work, her sister, spoke at the end. Sabrina Johnson spoke. And they had, I forget the man's name, but he's the one that recorded all of the Welsing Institute.
Danny Queen?
When she spoke. Yes, Danny Queen. He was there and he had all of these CDs of things, you know, the Institute. And so, or the times that she spoke at the Institute. I will post all of that information. I took a couple of pictures. I'll put that on Facebook. And then there's like another book that I was unable to get because I didn't have cash. Like, silly me, I should have had cash when I went. But I'll post the information to how to get that book that has like a lot of information about Dr. Welsing, and her sisters have written pieces in it. And I think it's only like a donation. Like, I don't think it's actually like a set price. But anywho, I'll make sure all of that information is on Facebook. I didn't get to see the whole thing because I accidentally lost my keys in my car while my car was running. So I had to deal with that. And then finding traffic in D.C. was, and it's raining and it's cold, all those things going on here. But what I did see, I was so grateful that I did go just to kind of be surrounded by all the people that Dr. Welsing was surrounded by. I geeked, however, because they mentioned the cows. So I made sure to clap really loud and give all this love for the cows so that people knew, because they mentioned like a couple things. Like, I think somebody else has a radio show that Dr. Welsing might have spoken on, and I don't know that person, but I do know the cows, and I do know Gus T. Renegade and the work that he does. So when they said the cows, I was like, woo, and clapped and everything, so that all those people will make sure to check out the cows. because I think it's highly constructive work, extremely constructive work. I made sure to go and speak with Ms. Sabrina Johnson and inform her that that is how I got put on, so to speak, was through the cows. And then I actually said, hopefully, we will get to talk to you on the radio. So who knows? Maybe when Mr. Gusky Renegade reaches back out to her, she can come on and talk for a bit and share some things. With all of that, I'm so excited because I really, 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 really wanted to go. And I did make it despite my difficulties and working overnight and all that stuff. So I'm on my way to the plantation. But one thing that I did want to comment on regarding these type of environments where we get together and we're supposed to be doing constructive work. Did I reach 5 minutes already? Oh, okay.
Not quite.
Okay, great. I understand why Mr. Neely Fuller Jr. says that these are non-constructive. He wasn't there. I was hoping he was there, but he was not there. And I understood why he was not there. Maybe for whatever reason, he could have just been like, that's not my scene. But I understand why these environments, and I used to feel that way, because it becomes it becomes a little less constructive and more about like kind of veneration or something like that. And in which case we're not really getting much done. And it becomes one of those things where we're saying, oh, I was there. Oh, I was there. People were even getting like signatures. And I was like, I don't even understand that. Like, you know, getting things signed. Like, how is that replacing the system of racism, white supremacy with justice? But to put myself out there, I actually almost brought my code book in case Mr. Fuller was there to ask him to sign it. But then I said, no, that's non-constructive. Well, that's not going to do anything. That's just me kind of being like a fan. And who needs that? This is serious work, serious business. War is being waged against us. Who needs the signatures? Moving on. So I didn't bring the book intentionally for that reason. So when I saw it, I recognized that. Just to say, you know, to be 360 with this, that is, it was beautiful. And in ways very constructive and in ways perhaps not constructive. And then I thought something else was very interesting as well. In the context of reading The Delectable Negro, how when people pass, I think Gus might have even said this yesterday, but, you know, we're not really paying much attention to these people when they're here, helping them, pushing their work even, like in the case of Dr. Frances Cresswell, pushing her work, making sure it's proliferated all around the world all the time. But when they die, all of a sudden, now everybody shows up. And I don't know if that's a form of conception. I don't know. But I wrote in my notes, when I took notes, I wrote Delectable Negro because it made me feel a little bit like that. Like in her death, there was some type of consumption, even though, and there was no white people present, which felt so good. Maybe that's why I'm so happy, because I could be someplace where there are no white people. But, and then I think a female caller before me mentioned like the terminology. Very interesting that she said that. Because
that
one of the things
is 5
that
minutes.
Okay, fine. If there's time later. I tried. I really did try. Okay, thank you all so much for listening.
Great effort. Hi, Jessica. Other folks that we have not heard from, if you have commentary, feel free.
Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Okay, how you doing, Mr. Gus? I've been listening to you for a while, but I had got disconnected because I was listening to you on Black Talk Radio. So that's why I found you at, and a friend of mine reconnected me. I was calling in. I got on a little late, like the previous caller, and I missed a lot, and I was told that you was doing workplace racism. Well, I wanted to share an example of workplace racism.
I definitely want to hear it. I just want to make sure we don't have confusion, because, and it's not anything that you did. You are absolutely correct. We do workplace racism, but it's Thursdays. It's every Thursday, 8 p.m. Eastern, 5 p.m. Pacific. Every Thursday, that is when workplace racism is, just because there's been lots of confusion for some reason about what day that's on. So it's Thursday, every Thursday at the same time, 8 p.m. Eastern, 7 p.m. Central, 5 p.m. Pacific. It's Thursday is workplace racism. Now, feel free. I'm always eager to hear about workplace racism.
Okay, before I even get into that, can you give me the days that you come on?
We have 3 set days every week. Thursday, workplace racism. Friday is always the book club, same time, 8 p.m. Eastern. And Saturday is always the compensatory call-in that we're doing now. all of the other broadcasts, we just post a date and you'll know in advance for when that program will be on. Like, we'll be on tomorrow. That's the Global Sunday Talk on Racism. That's already posted. The time, 3 p.m. Eastern. Just check the Facebook group. You can check Black Talk Radio. All of the other times are posted at least 24 hours in advance. Date, time, all that information.
All right, sir. Thank you. I appreciate that. Well, my example of workplace racism is that I'm new to finding out a lot of stuff that's going on. Like, I've always known about racism, but I wasn't very engaged because me being in a all black construct, I guess that's what I would call it, the neighborhood, schools, and what have you. So I'm going along, and I've been reading a lot, and a young white guy, younger than me, asked me, why am I reading? Well, he didn't know what I was reading, but it was a colorful book. It was actually a book on numerology, what I was checking out. But just the fact that I was walking around reading when none of them read anything, it was a problem to him. So he had to mention that to me. Why are you reading that? You at work. You don't need to be doing none of this. I say, well, you know, because he told me it was a children's book. I say, well, yeah, you know, would you like to see it? You know, it's not that big. You know, you could go through it pretty fast, you know, and that discouraged him. Not only was I reading, but I was willing to allow him to read what I was reading. And that shut the whole conversation down. Whether he could read or not is, I don't know, and it's actually beside the point. But, you know, they probe into any little thing that you have going on. And the best way to control that I've found is to offer that same food that they're discouraging you from taking, is to offer it to them. Especially when you're dealing with some dumbfounded people. Now, that may not be very, very important in some people's eyes, but for me it is. And to the brother that was going through all of that, happy birthday, man. You enjoy your birthday, and I hope you can continue to enjoy it throughout the rest of this weekend before you have to get back into the fold. And everybody else, I hope y'all have a good weekend, and I appreciate you taking my call.
For sure. I just want to say real quick, that was, in my view, a great way to handle the situation, because it sounds like this race soldier was trying to get in multiple insults, like to come in and, you know, and behave as though it was a problem or a violation you reading, which it has been at times under the system of white supremacy, and then to try to insult you further and say, oh, it looks like you're reading some sort of children's book, you know, like you're stupid or something, whatever it is you're reading, and just, you know, hey, you can read it. Would you like to read like that? And that is a question, I think. I always advocate staying in the question lane when responding, even when they get tacky on it, especially really when they get tacky. If you're going to respond at all other than documenting, which you should do either way, question. Always great when you can ask a question. Other folks we have not heard from?
May I be heard?
Yes, ma'am.
Hello, everyone. The first thing I wanted to talk about was the Melissa Harris-Perry segment. I also felt there was several things that she said was a little bit disturbing to me, especially like other people have pointed out about how, once again, her white mother was able to still practice racism on her child. And I know that, of course, like I've ran into several people around me who seem to think that, oh, if a white woman has a non-white child, then they're not racist because they have this child. But like what Cam has said before in like different shows is that if these white people are not helping out the non-white person,
better navigate the system of racism, white supremacy, and how are they really helping? So how is that relationship constructive? Also, just the going back to the fact that she does have a focus on women's rights, and this is not to disparage her or anything, but it made me think about something that Dr. Tommy Curry had said, basically how in academia, the better topics, I guess, to talk about is, you know, like lesbian, gay rights situations, and then or women's rights. And that seems like that actually seems better, makes non-white people more appealing for whites in the system of racism, white supremacy. That could be the reason why she was able to get the show on, I think it was MSNBC, I think that's what you all said. I never watched the show. So I wanted to say that, and I have been waiting for since Thursday, since the caller from Detroit had mentioned her tipping story, because within this past couple of weeks, I was out at a birthday dinner at a white-owned establishment. It's a national chain restaurant, and I was with a group of non-white people, black people. It was for a birthday dinner for one of my relatives' girlfriends, I guess, and we had gotten terrible service. I finally decided, after almost 2 hours of us, some people not getting their drinks, other people, and some people got appetizers. The appetizers were lukewarm at best. I finally decided to leave. My family ended up talking me into coming back because the restaurant decided they would basically kind of give us a free meal. They gave us like these little coupons to get like $15 off the meal. And since the restaurant was kind of cheap, they had like cheap entrees. I decided, okay, I'll basically get like a free, almost a free meal. Well, I say this because it was, I mentioned the story because I've mentioned before how I feel like white women, their job is to decrease our victimization and increase our tolerance of racism. And we had a white server. It was a white female. I think she was probably in her 40s, maybe early 50s. And she was the one who really couldn't tell us anything about the menu. Just getting terrible service. And when we finally decided, after, you know, just the problems that I already said, we finally decided, okay, well, let's talk to a manager because this is kind of ridiculous. She starts to cry. And I was just so disgusted. And some of the people at the table, like for some of my family members, they were somewhat comforting, you know, like, oh, well, it's not your fault. They should have got you help and this and the other. I felt like she could just be practicing racism, you know. How could this individual, if we have a large party, not want to provide us, you know, not ask for help if she obviously cannot handle 20 plus people? So I just felt like she's practicing racism, and by her crying, it's almost making it seem like we should feel sorry for her when this is her job. So it took all of me not to say something very rude and nasty and probably sprinkle a couple of cuss words in there too, because I was just completely disgusted. And I say all this because, like, there was at least one person at the table who somewhat agreed with me about the tipping situation. And we had, and me and my relative had spoken about it before, how we don't really like to tip white people. And for me, because of me listening to the show and also reading Mr. Neely Fuller Jr.'s book, you know, not to help white people, and, you know, we have more important things to do, I felt like I don't think that we should. I feel like, you know, also agreeing with Gus, if they provide, I guess, decent service, then maybe 10% or 5%. If, you know, if they're terrible, like what we had, don't give them anything at all. So I just wanted to, I guess, share that. Thank you for listening. I'll mute myself.
Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Awesome. This is Kent Steele, and I am in I think Santa Ana right now. And I just wanted to kind of touch on the tipping schedule or the tipping question. The schedule that I use for tipping is that victims of racism who are serving me, regardless of the service, they're going to get 20%. Non-victims of racism, suspected racists, they are going to start at 10%. And I keep a mental note of if I've had any sort of difficulties or problems. And I use this schedule for restaurants where I know that I will not be present in. If I know that I'm going to have a sustained presence in a restaurant, if I'm going to have to be there multiple times, or if it's just a usual spot, I usually tip around 15%, just you know, off the top. If I'm spending over $10, or if I'm spending under $10, then I only tip $1. When it comes to and I wanted to touch on another topic that we discussed during workplace racism. Just wanted to say, B. Stiviano was sued by Sterling because of her alleged illegal wiretapping of him. The suit was later dropped in December of that year. That was months after the wrongful gift suit was settled. That was settled in April of 2015. So for a large part of the year, V. Stiviano had to contend with potentially facing trouble for her recording of Donald Sterling, but it was later found, it was later just dropped. One thing that I wanted to say that I've noticed over the past week a lot is that suspected racists are, or I can just, I don't want to name call, but I think that these people are racist. People like Ben Shapiro and Milo Yiannopoulos, they're getting shared by a number of victims of racism that I like and respect. But I think that these people are very misguided in some of the sources of information that they're coming into. This reminds me of how Alex Jones used a number of victims of racism to appeal to other victims and to get them to share their clips on their websites. What they're doing is they're using anti-abortion and anti-trans rhetoric to appeal to victims of racism. And, you know, I'm not going to say that victims of racism aren't victimized by these two topics, but they've selected these two to begin making victims of racism think that these people are trustworthy sources of information and that they're not racist. I just want to remind all listeners that Ben Shapiro and Milo Yiannopoulos are part of a white supremacist apparatus on the internet that is largely responsible for the election of Donald Trump and the proliferation of very racist materials to lawmakers and media figures. One thing that I'm also noticing that's going on online with victims of racism is that there's a lot of what I'm calling open-ended trolling. So they will bait other victims into endless bickering and discussions by posing open-ended questions about issues and topics that make victims of racism that cause them to argue. And one topic that I'm seeing being used a lot is the gender topic. Posts will start out like with prompts like name reasons why you think black men and black women don't get along, or you know, are there any race of men that treat their women as badly as black men treat their women. And of course, this will be followed by a torrent of disturbed victims of racism arguing with other victims of racism. And it's not good. Just be on the lookout for that.
And then time. That is five. If we have time, we'll make sure to come back so you can get in your other commentary as well. That is very sensible tipping code from Mr. Steele. Other folks that we have not heard from, if you have a hand up and we have not heard from you at all, you should speak now.
Have you heard?
Oh, greetings, Thomas in New York.
Greetings, Mr. Gus. Greetings to all callers. Counter Reaches family. Happy Dr. Welzen Day. Dr. Welzen's on Earth Day. I had a few things I wanted to add in. Tips. And so, in New York, they kind of have a trick they pull where they add it in automatically to your bill. And then there's an extra line. It was added in as the gratuity, but there's an extra line next to the gratuity for a tip. So a lot of times people will pay a tip twice in New York, not realizing. Back when I first started dating in the city, I did that quite often, and then I figured out the little scheme they were running. So just to say a tip, according to the dictionary, is a piece of inside information, especially to the advantage of the person getting it. And a gratuity is a free gift, a present, a donation that is often given without compensation or equivalent. So, really, tips are not the best words to be using. So I would say, if you get a bill and it says tip, why don't you write something that's probably to the waiters at Nancy's you want and see what happens. White people do all the time. They tip with go back to your country or a nigger or something like that in the tip box. And that's how they tip. The last clip you played was funny. That little girl already had such codification. I thought it was great. It sounded a lot like that retired Chris Rock clip, about an uncle. It's white people, married to a white woman, like that type of thing. And I find a lot of so-called militant blacks to have white wives, or white children with white women, which I find very interesting. As far as this week for me, I just wanted to say I was at working in a emergency room the other night, and from the time I walked into the door, there's a black man in a room screaming, "Help! Help! Help! Help!" So they had the door closed and the lights out, so you couldn't really see. And then a couple of nurses went to the door and told him, keep it down, and they'll let him go once he calms down. And they had him strapped to a bed. So of course, I got nosy, so I went and looked, and he was strapped to the bed. And he only had on his boxer shorts. And, he was saying, help, I want to go home to my kids. My kids are home by themselves. And they're like, they're not going to let you go unless you calm down. And obviously, this guy is seriously mentally ill. Just couldn't shut up long enough for them to, let him go. However, to punish him, the nurses turned the light on and opened the shade to the door. So as I'm cleaning the ER, I noticed a lot of the people, in particular the white people who are waiting for someone to get out the ER, are standing by this door. And that's when I realized the light and everything was on, and they could see the guy. Here this guy is, at this point, he's on his knees on the bed trying to bite off the shackles, and his boxer shorts are down by his ankles, so his penis is all exposed. And they're just sitting there laughing, and they're going to tell other people to come and look. And it just, I went and said something to them, like, "Listen, why don't y'all close that curtain? It's not right." "Oh, he's, giving us a hard time tonight, so, you know, we're going to leave it like that. And I just felt like that was cool. And then I went to go inside the ER, another room that you have to have access to, special access to, but I have to go in there to, you know, make the beds. So it's the psych ER. And when I went in there to do my job, I asked the girl behind the desk, like, hey, you know, you got one outside that's screaming. And they said, oh, we already told them that we don't want him in here. Send him home. So here's someone with a mental illness that's not going to get help. Just, you know, the way they do us in the healthcare system is extremely gruesome, to say the least. The last thing I wanted to say, and this is what, when I heard the guy yelling, it brought me back to the police robber story and how, you know, they put you in the psych ward of the prison and everyone's just sitting and yelling and banging on the wall and uncontrollably. And I would be willing to bet that this man probably was in something like that because, you know, he had all the characteristics. And I did watch episode 3 of the Khalif Browder story. And I must say, you know, the criminal justice system in New York is just appalling. This is just looking at what his family went through, already having one of the brothers accused of being this big time rapist, which was the case I remember when I was a kid. That was all over the news. I'm like, man, dude, I remember this. And I found out that he was charged with nothing. And I'm moving on. Thank you. I'm sorry.
No apology needed. Other folks that we have not heard from, if you had commentary, feel free.
May I be heard?
Yes, ma'am.
Okay. Good evening to Gus, the host, and to all the callers and listeners. Just a couple of things. Just listening to the report of the guy that had went to jail for the attempted murder, and he talked about that 70% recidivism rate. And it's just, you know, listening to him, it's like, yeah, that's about right. Even to say that, like, in California, they'll give you $200 and a bus ticket, you know, as opposed to New York, you get $40, you know. And I know in the book, The New Jim Crow, where Michelle Alexander talked about how hard it is for them to, you know, really get back up on their feet once they get out of here. So, and so it's set up to get that 70% recidivism rate. They know exactly what they're doing. So I just wanted to comment on that. But I really wanted to comment on the Melissa Harris. Oh, let me say this about the tipping. I think it was Ken who said something about he gives a dollar. I think if he spends less than $10, he gives a dollar, which is like good. I think the thing we have to remember, though, too, when it comes to tips, tips were really supposed to be given almost really like for service over and beyond what, you know, what they do. And I know today people act as if it's just like, well, you're supposed to tip me. I only make $2 an hour, but it's like you knew that when you took that job. And so, you know, I just want to say that, and I just think that maybe we just need to rethink when it comes to tips, giving tips, because tips are really supposed to be given because, you know, I felt that you had given me great service over and beyond, which is you should be given great service, period. But it just should be, you know, things that's over and beyond what they normally do. I just want to throw that out there, if, you know, and hopefully maybe that can help. As far as Melissa Harris Perry, I agree with you. I never heard her talk like that. You know, like you say, the cussing. I think the thing when she first started and how, you know, what did she say about, I guess it's Barack Obama's mother and father had been together. If I heard right, he wouldn't have been elected president. But then she goes on to say that, you know, he got everything from his mother. White mommies for everybody. Okay. So then, you know, she goes on, she talks and talks and talks. And basically Thomas of New York said what I was going to say. You know, to say, you know, my dad is just intensely race conscious, you know, and the struggle continues. And I'm sitting up here listening to this and I'm like, he's intensely race conscious. And yet he has a white wife. And that stuff floors me all the time. And so Thomas was correct that you can, I tend to see it in black men that, you know, who are just so down with the cause, who have white wives, so who have children by white women. And you can get these debates on Facebook too about, you know, can you be pro black and marry outside your race? So I just thought that was excuse me. I just thought that was, I mean, that just really stood out for me. You know, he was intensely race conscious, you know. And I'm like, he has a white wife. Not that intensely race conscious. You can believe that if you want to. That's your father. You have the right to believe about your father anything you want to. But I'm just like, no, he's not as race conscious or intensely race conscious as you may want to think that he is. And from what she says, her mother was telling her about giving her a mirror and making sure you're looking down there and know what it is. And then, you know, I'm sitting back saying, well, yeah, it seems to me that's probably what something a white woman would be talking about. And we just know if that's the conversation, she wasn't helping him in this intense race consciousness that her father was supposedly to have. So I just thought that was just very, it just stood out to me. It really did just, you know, stood out to me. And I do agree, though, listening to her, it's just like, you know, I don't ever remember her sounding anything like this, the cussing, you know, even sometimes the high shrillness of her voice and anything like that. So I just wanted to mention that. With that, I'll mute my line. Thanks for taking my call.
Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Yes, sir. Greetings to you, the host, the callers, and the listeners. I wanted to respond to something one of the female callers said a little earlier about when she went to the Welsing Institute to honor Dr. Welsing, Dr. Frances Welsing, that she was surrounded by black people and that there were no white people present. And I think she was saying that she felt a calm or she felt happy, something along those lines. And I just wanted to say it really is calming to be around just black people and to not have white people present at all. When I had spent some time in Ghana, maybe 3.5 months out there, for the first 3 weeks, I didn't have to see a single white person. And it was the only time I had ever experienced that in my entire life. And it was the most amazing thing that I had ever experienced. White people just being around, they're already opposing you. They're already trying to, or they're already actually doing something to you. They're doing something to harm you, to kill you. And when they were not around, even though I could see the pictures of them on billboards and stuff like that, and I could feel their presence as far as the laws and the way people act, them not actually physically being in my visual, you know, where I could see them, it was very, very, very comforting. Another thing is I think we should study Vietnam strategy, how they defeated America. I was watching a documentary, and it was saying that the people of Vietnam, they studied the game of Go, where they said the strategy of the Vietnam people was that they surrounded the white people, as in they didn't allow the white people to get in big groups and kind of where it's just solely non-white area. It was always mixed. So whenever the white people were bombing areas, they were often having to hit their own people also. So it's kind of like you're making the white people or the racists pay, you know, they still have to take casualties if they're going to take us out. And the other thing was that I think we should stay away from white people as much as possible. I know it's not very possible to stay completely away from them, but if it's not necessary to be around them, you should probably just not be around them. I take that for myself. Oppose white people in every way possible, with your whole being, oppose them. They oppose you, they oppose your life. That means they're killing you. They're not just trying to, they're actually killing you, actively killing you. And so you have to oppose that, and you have to oppose them completely. And I think that we should use every tool to its fullest potential,
And I think that as long as white people are on the earth, that we'll have problems. And I just really want to solve this problem of racism, white supremacy, and white people. And I hope everybody the best. Thank you.
Right on. Other folks that we have not heard from, folks who have a hand up that we've not heard from, you should speak right now.
Hello.
Be heard.
Heard both of you. We'll get the female caller first.
Okay. Thank you so much for taking my call. I called first because I heard Mr. Rob, and I just want to let him know that, you know, we are here to help you and support you, and we thank you for your words. And if you need more than just kind words, you know, don't be afraid to ask, because we're here to help you. Also wanted to talk about Dr. Perry, and I think something we need to be careful of in general is getting too comfortable with each other. And I think maybe she had talked to a black, I don't know who was interviewing her. I would just assume it was another black person, because she did start using profanity. And we need to be careful to not get that comfortable that we start disrespecting each other. And I know she didn't mean it as a disrespect when she was talking to her, but I don't know. I don't think that's the language we should use. Not just because you don't allow it on the show. I don't think it's helpful. It's not constructive. It doesn't lift us up. I know in my family, I don't come from that kind of family. There was a show like on TV called Girlfriends. When they started doing that, I had to start watching. I was like, I don't know black people who just cuss around each other like that just because. So I think we need to be careful of that and respect one another. And I think that's all. If I remember something, I'll say it, but that's all I remember from right now. Just those two things. Thank you.
I know. Caller in Florida, you were going to speak as well?
Yes, sir. Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
All right. Thank you, sir. Greetings to Gus, the host, the listeners and callers. I wanted to go through some of the audio segments. The first was, I think, that they were talking about, I guess it was something called the Black Diamond. And a non-white female was saying how, I guess it was white people that was coming back to apologize to her. I guess like they were terrorizing her at some point. And I just noticed how that can be a pattern where they'll, or white supremacist suspects will say that, you know, they apologize or that they're sorry, to, I guess, to try to confuse us. But the next one was I think it was the dating segment or the online dating, where the guy from out of Alabama, he sent the message to the white person, and the statement, like another phrase that I'm starting to pick up on, is that they'll say, well, we'll continue to not tolerate racism of any kind. I don't think they never really explain what that means, because I've noticed that they'll say that too in the statement release. It'll either be that or, you know, not tolerate, or there is no place for this, or no, there is no place for racism. So it just sounds very vague. And the next was it was a guy, I think that was the guy who usually, I think he may be incarcerated. I guess what was the black male's name?
Flores Forbes. He was in the Black Panther Party.
Okay. Yes, sir. All right. I think he was the guy that I was mentioning how we are under an oppressive system. And he was interested how he listed the different aspects of it. And, you know, I understand BGQ, but he ended it, I believe, with the LGBT thing. And I found that interesting how I noticed how a lot of people, white, non-white, will constantly compare the plights of non-white people under racism with the thing with the LGBT. And, you know, I'm for people not being mistreated, but I'm just noticing that comparison pattern. And the last of all was the King Kong film, or that segment. And, you know, I was thinking about how Dr. Wilson was mentioned. I wonder, like, has she ever analyzed that segment the part of that movie, the famous building scene, like climbing that building structure, because I know she talks about or has talked about like tall structures having like a sexual connotation to it, and you know him climbing that tall building, you know, a bunch of white planes, he's swatting at white planes, holding a white woman. You know, I thought that was a Wilson moment. I don't know if she's ever analyzed it, but you know, I was thinking about that when that audio was playing. In the end off, there's a wrestler, I don't know if you've heard of her, Gus. They named her Awesome Kong. You could put it in Google and see what the wrestler looks like, a female wrestler. And, you know, it's interesting how they can take names of certain movies and apply it to black people. So I thought that was interesting, and that's all I have for now. Thank you.
Wacky. Fascinating. I'm looking at the images now. Other folks who have commentary that we've not heard from, lines should be open. Feel free.
Can I be heard?
Female. Okay.
Hello?
Yes, we can hear you.
Yes. Oh, hi there. Hi, guys. Greetings to all the callers. I just want to say this is a very happy day. I've been kind of cheery all day just thinking about Dr. Francis Cresswell's name. I spent a lot of the day listening to older podcasts from the cows. I listened to episode 20, her 20th visit, rather, at the cows today. That was such a phenomenal episode, and so that really, really encouraged me. It's very encouraging. I'm in a tragic arrangement. I'm actually in therapy as well. And I have a black therapist who is screaming for me to get out of this arrangement I'm in. She knows very intimate details of the stuff that I've endured. But it's also kind of therapeutic for her because I was able to kind of put her on to Dr. Frances Cresswell's name and a lot of the stuff that I've learned that she, you know, wasn't even aware of. And so it's just, it's kind of just kind of a chaotic time in my life. I spent a lot of my time today studying as well. I have a background in biology, and like Dr. Francis Cresswell Dean, had ambitions towards going to medical school, and kind of got veered off track, got married, and kind of put that on the back burner. And I come out of Hampton University, and a lot of the students in my class are matching to their residencies. And so, you know, they're putting their, you know, pictures all over Facebook about, you know, where they match to. And it's just, it's kind of hard to watch because it's just like, you know, I feel like that should be me. Like I should be, you know, utilizing the gifts that God gave me, my brain, my energy, my focus, my drive, my knowledge towards bettering my community. And so today was in Panera Bread with the MCAT book. And it's just really interesting whenever, you know, I am in public studying, just kind of the gymnastics white people do to kind of get your attention or to get in your eye shot, so to speak. You know, just laughing really loud, standing a little too close. You know, just I really make it hard for anyone to make eye contact with me when I'm studying. So I'm always, my vision's always straight down. You know, sometimes I'll have my head on my hand on my head looking down, and they're just so bold. They'll tap you on the shoulder, like, what are you reading? You know, what are you looking at? That's a big book there. And it's just, it's very invasive, and it's very telling. And so I just really wanted to pose, like, a question to my mom. I should say this, when she used to ride the bus to work, she told me, you know, because she's always reading, and she'd be reading books on the bus, and she would make a purposeful effort to hide the cover of her book when she was on the bus, because white people will just do gymnastics in order to see what you're reading. And so I can spend my time, you know, in a library or just kind of really siphon myself off, but I do enjoy being in a place where it's lively because it helps me to stay awake. But what types of, I mean, I have earphones on. What types of mechanisms would you encourage in order to kind of make it known that I don't want to be bothered. Like, don't talk to me when it's clear that I'm trying to study.
Folks can give their response to that question as they go. If you have techniques when you're out in public, when white people are trying to demand your attention and what are you reading? And, you know, these just random conversations. I have been a long time advocate, and I practice it myself, planned ignoring, where I don't have headphones on and I just choose not to respond to you. And that works. And I mean, it's a little, I think it just takes some practice, because it's not normal to just not respond to people if they speak or what have you. But if I'm by myself, I'm reading, and this is clearly not a constructive conversation, and or I'm just not interested in talking to you right now. I'm studying, I'm reading my book, or I'm doing whatever. I just don't say anything, and that normally works. Like, they'll give it one or two goes, and then after they don't respond, no good nigga, and they'll just, you know, go about doing whatever they do. But I'm a big advocate of just planned ignoring. I do not have to, if I'm not on my job or what have you, I'm on my time, I do not have to say a word. I don't even have to look in your direction. And generally, that works with no problem. There was another female caller who spoke up simultaneously. Were you going to comment as well? Are you still with us, or did I not hear that correctly?
Hello?
Oh, yes, ma'am. We can hear you. Hi, Princess.
Hi, yeah. I was just calling in.
Your volume is a little low. If you can speak up, please.
I'm fine. I would have called in earlier, but I was battling the grill outside. Got that under control. But I was just calling in to comment on just in general, some of the stuff I was going through at work. So I have been doing some documentation, getting stuff together, and then researching some sites as far as seeking some legal advice on my situation, because as of now, I haven't received any communication from my home office or store location. I've been floating around to these different stores, and it's almost as if I'm like going as the hired help to various plantations that are in need of extra hands. That's what it kind of mirrors and feels like. Even when I report to duty and they log me in the system, it's the certain codes that they use, terminology is borrowed or just certain things that they, the terminologies that they use when entering you into the system is just real weird, interesting though. But like I said, you know, they tried to basically say that it was an accident that they had accepted me as a permanent hire at this location, and that there was some type of miscommunication. And like I said, I had never been a floating manager or anything. I was hired as a manager when I first applied, so... you know, I had to travel almost close to 50 miles between several locations at each time throughout last week. And I'm having to travel, 30 miles to tomorrow to this other location out in Marion Oaks. And so, again, all this coming out of my pocket, and I haven't received any word on anything. But I've just been pretty cool and chill about it because, like I said, I know what's going on, and I know I didn't do anything, so I don't have anything to worry about. But it's just frustrating to see how, you know, white people can take things upon themselves to try and inconvenience black people in their lives and really just that feeling of being powerless to some degree. And no matter what we do as us being codified and, you know, trying to read anything to counter racism, it just seems like it's to no avail. So I don't know. It's just really frustrating because, you know, I have mainly it's hard just being around most family members because they're just not receptive to reality. So trying to explain things to them as far as what's going on the job is kind of hard. So I try and usually keep that to myself, just to keep the peace. But it's just really frustrating because, like I said, I've been there what 30 or 40 days, and already it's major controversy. But another thing I'd just like to touch on is that, I don't know, there's something that's been on my mind is about, you know, parents and having illegitimate kids that you don't care about, or just don't have interest in seeing your offspring, you know, prosper in any way. You know, it just seems like it's generational that, you know, people get together and have children and, you know, they just send them out into the world and expect, you know, them to somehow survive without giving them any type of tools or resources. And especially for Black people, like we have parents and, you know, people in our former generation that fight amongst each other to even fight against their own children to keep them
30 seconds
block them from. Okay, go ahead.
You sure?
I'm positive.
We should have time. We'll come back. I know a couple other folks had additional commentary as well. Folks we have not heard from at all, you should speak up now if you have a hand up and we have not heard from you.
Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Okay. Greetings, Gus, and greetings to all the callers. Rob in Wisconsin, we're going to be praying for you, brother. Under the system of white supremacy, any of us can be in those situations of that what you're in. So keep your head up, and we'll be praying and thinking about you. In regards, I wanted to comment about the Melissa Harris Perry clip. I'm the type of same person that, you know, not interested and not a big fan of hers. But when I heard that clip, you know, just like you guys, I was like, wow, that was interesting. She still sounded kind of irritating to me, but at the same time, she did drop some things that I was kind of listening to in regards to making sense, because, you know, she mentioned that if you get rid of Donald Trump tomorrow or next 4 years or so, white, you know, the system will still be here. She mentioned the same thing about Dylann Roof, who will be executed soon. You know, you kill Dylann Roof, white supremacy will still be here. So I thought that was quite interesting. In regards to the comments about, I know, in her, as far as her father being a Black militant or a race-conscious man with a white wife, I thought about the conversation you had with the non-white Black male in Brazil that was talking about some of the militant writers in Brazil married to white women. So I thought about that conversation when that came up. And also too, I wanted to comment. I went to the event that you advertised on the show in Chicago, the white supremacy seminar that it was called. The thing was that I didn't find it, you know, too productive. I think the presenters kind of had their, well, I would say this, the one good thing was they both, there were two presenters, a black female and a black man. And generally, they both gave definitions of racism, which was a good thing. You know, if you're going to talk about, you know, just like on the show, you're going to talk about racism, give your definition. And they gave their definitions, and it was like, So the first presenter presented her definition as racial prejudice plus white people misuse of a system or institution. So it was kind of confusing. The second presenter even had a more vague definition, and he said racism is the practice of white supremacy. So I was like, wow, okay. And it was just, you know, it was just very, very vague, you know, and I, to me, it kind of, you know, I don't know, maybe other people found it interesting, but I didn't find it too interesting because it was not very clear, you know. I saw you posted on the Cal's Facebook page Dr. Welsing's definition, and that's a definition that should resonate with a lot of people, also including Neely Fuller's definition of white supremacy. So didn't find it too productive. You know, like I said, maybe somebody else got something constructive out of it, but, you know, I really didn't. So that is my report from that conference from last week. That's all I have. I'll be my last.
Nice. Glad you were able to attend. Wish it had been, I guess, a better investment of your time and energy. But at least, in my view, at least us talking about racism, white supremacy is heading in the correct direction, I hope. Anyone that we have missed completely, folks that we missed entirely? Do we get everybody? Everybody who dialed in with a hand up? Spectacular. One of our listeners in the Missouri area, he said, hearing about the passing of the great Chuck Berry is most interesting to me since I already watched the 1985 film Back to the Future, where Michael J. Fox goes back to 1955, and it's implied that he, Michael J. Fox, suspected racist, inspired Chuck Berry's music and style. White people have to take credit for everything. Absolutely. Other folks, since we didn't miss anybody. Making sure no lollygagging, waiting until the last minute. Spectacular. Any of the folks who had a final comment that they wanted to get in, you can take 60 seconds. I think Princess might have had an additional comment. Yeah. I think Mr. Steele.
Oh. Can I be heard?
Can I be?
Let's see. We'll get Mr. Steele first. You want to get your 60 seconds?
Sure. I just wanted to say that finally, there was reports that Amy Schumer and her latest Netflix special has been receiving less than stellar ratings. And I noticed that a number of suspected racist females were going to great lengths to defend Amy Schumer against attacks that were, quote-unquote, categorized as body shaming, which is interesting because these same Amy Schumer fans seem to have no problem with her race shaming and her constant gender bashing. So it's just very interesting that they would not support comedy going in a certain direction when it's directed toward suspected racist females. Her ratings for that special, by the way, were so bad that it inspired Netflix to do away with their star rating system and go to a thumbs up, thumbs down system. Also, I just wanted to say that beware of, there's a proliferation of stock market and scams that are going around with Black people. If you see any posts about pay to learn how to trade commodities or how to trade options or binary options, please stay away from those. If you are interested in learning how to trade, you can learn that for free on a website called babypips.com. You know, I have no affiliation with that website, so I'm not advertising for them or anything like that. Just letting you know so you don't get robbed of, you know, $200 to $500, which they normally charge for these services. Thank you so much.
For sure. The male caller who spoke up simultaneously, were you going to comment?
Yes, I was wanting to ask you a little bit more about this incident that happened with Van Jones and this white woman where he was called a house nigger. And I was wanting to know, what was your viewpoints and all of the callers that's going to be left in these last few minutes? What was your comments on that, and how did you feel when you found out about this particular situation? And I put myself on mute.
This is the first I've heard of it, so I'd have to get more information just based on what you shared. It sounds like the type of thing that happens on a regular basis. White people name calling the non-white people. Now, I don't know the context of why this white person was calling Van Jones a quote unquote house nigger. I can say that I have heard white people use those type of insults before. Like, I've heard white people call other Black people Uncle Toms and sell out. Like, Clarence Thomas is a real popular one. Justice Thomas, where I'll hear white people. I think a white person got in trouble recently for calling him Uncle Thomas. And then he had to go. I think he tweeted it. And then he had to retract what he had said and what have you. I do not accept any criticisms of a white person if that was the context of any non-white person. If you want to criticize somebody about racism, white supremacy, you can start with the mirror, you can start with your children, you can start with your parents. I'm sure there are tons of white people that live right where you do, if not in your same house, and you can critique their effort at dealing with racism. That's just a tacky illustration of white supremacy in my view. That's all I would have to say about it. Anybody else have an additional comment that they wanted to get in? Or I think we had a question from Jessica about how you deal if you're out in public and whites are spying and snooping on what you're reading or what have you. Anyone want to respond to that either? Also,
can I be heard?
Yes, M.A.
Fantastic. I wanted to comment quickly on the tipping. I don't tip. I don't care. It was weird at first because I felt like I was just being, and by when I say I don't tip, I mean I don't tip white people. I felt like I was being judged. I was like that Black person who doesn't tip, you know, but whatever. That's my money that I work really, really hard for, and I'm not giving it to white people unless I have to. And tipping, I don't have to, so I'm not. And I usually feel like I can feel the racism anyway. I'm the one in Virginia, so it's like, you know, for all I know, who knows what you really did? You know what I'm saying? So I don't feel no type of way about it anymore. I don't tip white people, period. I don't do anything for white people that I don't have to do. And it's hard at first because it's not necessarily how I was, quote, unquote, raised. But that's who I am now. I'm not doing anything for white people. I keep my books covered, for Jessica's question. I keep my books covered. But I also ignore white people. Again, it felt weird at first because it's just not really natural to me to be that way. But I don't, like, even if they smile at me, look at me, I've even trained myself to just get, like, to have my mean girl face, like, what, just so you understand that it's not working on me. I see right through all of your racist tactics, you know. So that's just my quote. But also I wanted to say something to Miss Jessica. It's never too late. It seems like you already have your prereqs. So if you're looking at people getting matched with their residencies, so what? I'm someone, just, you know, to be transparent, didn't have any. I have my BA, but it has nothing to do with science whatsoever. So I have to get all of my science and math requirements from the very beginning to then apply to
to then get in and do 4 years, then get matched with a residency. Who knows how old I'll be when I'm done, but it doesn't matter. So just in case, like, I could hear it in you. And I feel the same way, too. Like, I look at my friends and other people look like they're doing. But the truth is, once they graduate, I mean, you start working, and if it took you a little longer, who cares? You'll be able to give that to your patients more than people who just went straight through. And that's the truth. Talk to anyone who's been in college the whole time. They don't have what you have. So you don't have to feel funny about that. And if it's something that you really, really want to do, go ahead and do it. And you can. And I just wanted to say that because I totally understand. Like, I totally get that. Thank you for listening.
Appreciate that. Any other comments? Folks wanted to make sure they get in the last few 5 minutes or so. Question about tipping, the question about being out in public and not being bothered by whites. Did anybody catch the Camp of the Saints book, Brouhaha? I think GOP Congressman Stephen King was boasting about this book. It's similar to the Turner Diaries, where even though it's fiction, it's similar to Lothrop Stoddard's Rising Tide of Color, where it's non-white people are a threat to white people, and if we don't watch out, you know, the non-whites, they're going to ruin everything. And of course, black males will be raping white women. Any thoughts on that? Feel free.
Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
I know I've commented before about me reading in public and white people coming up to me. So one of the good things that I like to do is I like to flip the script, turn the table. So if it's a book, especially a book that might not be appeasing to white people, I show it to them and I tell them, sir, what are you reading? Oh, I'm reading Message to the Black Man by Elijah Muhammad. You know, the guy who says that white people are devils. So that'll kind of shoo
them
away. So that's just my 2 cents.
Can I be
heard? Yes, sir.
Regarding, I guess, the prying eyes of suspected racists, I will again suggest if you are using any sort of digital screens, to read or communicate, buy yourself a privacy screen protector. They're relatively cheap, and they basically eliminate the ability for suspected racists to see what is on your screen if they are looking at your device at an angle, which is where most of them are going to be positioned relative to your device. So if you really, really are interested in that, use that. Another technique that I use to eliminate unnecessary communication is, hey, have earphones on you at all times. I usually have one ear plugged by myself wherever I go for the most part. And it allows me to selectively engage racists that may want to prompt me for discussion. I can just quickly point to my earphone and say, hey, you know, and shrug my shoulders. So that is a really non-confrontational way of dealing with this problem that so many of us encounter. Thank you.
Got time for one other?
Hello.
Yes, ma'am.
Hi, I wonder, I guess you talked about the comment about Steve King and the children not wanting the, I guess, non-white children. I mean, I don't want any white children. He don't want to mix with me, I don't want to mix with him. And to be honest, that's what they did. They eliminated or tried to exterminate Native Americans so that they could bring in their children and do things their way. When they brought in black people as slaves, they intermingle with them to make sure some of those children, I mean, they still call them black, but you know, some of the children were white and they brainwashed them into their way. No, they don't want people that they can't brainwash. And I mean, that's just, he was kind of saying the truth from white people. And I don't know, that's just what I thought. That's what they really want. He was bold enough to say it. And I noticed a lot of white people got mad, probably because some of the things we've talked about earlier, how they want to have sexual relations with us, and because they, I don't know what they think, but some of them want to do that, and those are the ones that seem angry. It's, oh, well, we should get together. No, we shouldn't. They're not good for us. Thank you.
Right on. That will wrap us for this week's compensatory call-in. We, however, will be here in about 12 hours, a little more than 12 hours, for the Global Sunday Talk on Racism. Our international participants will be with us tomorrow. That is the earlier broadcast, so it'll be 3 p.m. Eastern, 2 p.m. Central, 12 noon Pacific. We'll be good. We'll have folks in from the UK area, lots of different spots on the globe. We will review racism, white supremacy. We'll be good to hear from some of our callers in the England area about the whole kerfuffle with Samuel L. Jackson and what he said about black British actors taking roles because of the system that was already placed to blame, to hear their thoughts, because I've seen some of the articles that some black Brits have written in response to all that, just, as we said before, keeping conflict going, how the system is perpetuated. But that'll be tomorrow. Looking forward to hearing commentary. If you have other questions, you can't find something in the archives, you have guest suggestions, if you attended the ceremony for Dr. Welsing today and you want to just share your observations and comments, definitely share untiljustice@gmail.com. You can feel free to drop me an email. With that, thanks for everyone tuning in, all of the callers, listeners. I hope it was worthy of your time and energy. As I state consistently, sobriety would be best under conditions of white supremacy. That segment where they were talking about the history of white supremacy in Seattle, Washington, where they said one of the problems was that the non-white workers, they didn't drink alcohol so they could be more efficient. Exactly. That is a tradition we should continue. And I think our brain computer on Dr. Welsing's birthday, I think she for sure would encourage us to take care of our health, our brain computer, tobacco, alcohol, cannabis, any other narcotics that they come out with. That is not going to help us neutralize racist man, racist woman, racist child. And in fact, being under the influence has consistently proven to make it easier for the Darren Wilsons and Daniel Holtzclaws of the world to terrorize, rape, and pillage black people. Sobriety would be best. That said, Creator, we ask that you help us remain patient with other black people, victims of white supremacy. We ask that you help us remain patient with ourselves. Remind us to demonstrate the highest levels of black self-respect at all times, in all places, each and every time we are in contact with another black person. It has been time. Replace white supremacy with justice immediately. Cal signing out. Thanks all for tuning in.
Nigga, you're so brainwashed.
I'm a victim, your brother.
Problem. You're a victim.
I'm a victim of 400 years of conditioning.
Shut up.
The man has programmed my conditioning. Mm-hmm. Even my conditioning has been conditioned.